is in my division. Got a quick technical issue here. Okay, my intent today is to talk about our civil rights program very briefly, and I'll leave plenty of time for questions. I know there's a lot of interest in several of the things going on right now at MnDOT, and certainly with our civil rights, CBE, and workforce.
I think we have a written handout. Is that correct? About if there's problems with the overhead.
Yeah, we'll let him work on that. And
we could probably get going with members have something before us here. No, apparently not.
We could hand it out.
Okay, I think we have it here. Then you can pass it out. Is that something doable? Maybe while that's starting, Ms. Arzino, you can begin your presentation.
Okay. Thank you. And what I wanted to do is just quickly talk about the two areas in our civil rights office. The first is disadvantaged business enterprise that ensures and develops opportunity for women and minority-owned businesses. The employment and on-the-job training is a federal program, ensures training and job positions for women and minorities on these federally funded projects that we pursue as a department. I'm here to accept some responsibility for our progress and our what we've done in the past in this area. And it certainly isn't as good as we would like to see. If you look at the third page of the handout, you'll see that our historical goals versus that what we actually attained is not very good. We've met it, I think, one time since 2000, we've met our goal. And certainly we recognize that there is an opportunity for improvement. So if we can put that up, I'll talk about that. Sorry about the inconvenience on this. Okay, so here is the listing of our overall goal versus that which was attained, and you can see that it was only in 2007 on this listing where we met our goal. We're not happy with that performance, and we want that to change. Now, we were successful on the 35W bridge. We feel good about what occurred there. We had a minority goal of 11% for workers on that. We achieved 14.7. Women was 6% goal. We achieved 3.4, which although it didn't meet the goal, is much better than it has been historically. The DBE goal was 10%. We achieved 14%. And I think what that shows is that we can do better in this area. Furthermore, we recently submitted a report here on our DBE and civil rights and employment program. And it talks about the fact that we have not done a good job. We're trying to be transparent with that. We want to accept responsibility for that, but more importantly, we want to move forward with a program that will provide us with the foundation that's needed to work for both the minority community and the contractors. The economic stimulus package is something that I know that all of you are interested in and how we're going to perform with that. And so I wanted to address that next.
Yes, Representative Champion. Before you go to the economic stimulus package, I just want to back up on the DBE acknowledgement page that you have, just so that we have some clarity, or the committee has some clarity, even around 2006, 2007, when you said that those are the two times by which MnDOT attaining their goal.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think it was 2007 is what I meant to say, if I said something different.
Okay, let me ask this question. So, ma'am,
yes, Representative Champion.
Now let's talk about how goals are set, number one, and then also how you guys determine if a goal has in fact been attained. Can you explain that for us, please?
Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, would you mind if I move through the presentation first and then we came back to that, and I could invite Hope up to the table to help. But I'd like to get an overall view of this, and then I'd be glad to deal with those specific questions if that's all right with you.
Representative Champion.
I would prefer to talk about this first before we even get to the economic stimulus, because I think that some discussion that we have laying this groundwork as to the goals will also have some bearing on our concerns around whether MnDOT will reach or attain the goals even once the stimulus package comes first.
Mr. Arsene, if you could respond.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, I'm going to ask for Hope Jensen to come up and respond to that specific question.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Hope Jensen. I'm the Director of the Office of Civil Rights with the Department of Transportation. The question regarded how we come up with our annual overall goal, there is a federal formula that is given to us that we must follow that is basically based on the number of ready, willing, and able certified businesses that are in the disadvantaged business program. So we take a look at previous bidders lists, not just those that were successful in attaining subcontracting, but those that expressed interest in subcontracting. We recognize one of our issues is that we need to greatly expand the number of disadvantaged businesses that are certified within the program, and we are working to do that actively. So as we get more ready, willing, and able DBE businesses into the program, we will be able to set higher goals and achieve higher participation.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And forgive me if you said this or if I actually should understand this, but when you follow a year across, when the terms race conscious, race neutral, overall goal attained, would you just explain what that means, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the term race neutral and race conscious are given to us with the federal regulations enacted by Congress, so that's where those terms come from. That federal regulation requires us to achieve the maximum amount of the goal possible through race neutral means. So we try to determine how much of our goal we are able to meet without setting specific numerical race-conscious goals on our projects. And when I use the term race, I mean race and gender. So we set numerical race and gender goals on our projects, and but we try to achieve as much of that participation as we can in a race-neutral fashion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Champion.
Is it not true, Ms. Jensen, that as you look at these things, that there's been a history of discrimination when you think in terms of inclusion, and therefore there are some specific things that MnDOT should try to do to increase the pool or the reach into communities that are disadvantaged?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, yes, the purpose of this program, or the reason that it was initially put into place, was to remedy past discrimination. The federal government acknowledged that in the construction industry there had been a history of discrimination. The program is meant to remedy that by providing a level playing field to minority and women-owned businesses. Here in Minnesota, our program was enjoined in 1998, and we spent several years without a program. And once we were able to bring the program back with multiple changes to the program, we have steadily been increasing the numbers of businesses that have been participating in the program. And it's been sort of an incremental process to continue to grow this pool of minority and women-owned businesses.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Champion.
When you say that there's a pool to obtain more minorities of people of color and women, what tools do you presently use, and how much do you spend on those potential tools?
Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, if we could go through this presentation and talk about what we're doing today to improve this program, to create new opportunities, and to make sure that we set in place consequences for lack of performing in this area, I think those questions may have a little better, they might be better set up for us.
And then to that point, what I would hope that your presentation may be able to answer were, you know, questions such as, you know, what corrective actions are you taking to ensure that contractors will meet these new goals? And do you have resources? Do you have funding at MnDOT so that you can do this and make those commitments? I think that would be really important to do on the record. We have a lot of interest in this. So just as a chair, those are a couple of things on my mind as you move forward here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will go very quickly through here, but I think it's important to set this up. And I'm going to skip the stimulus for right now. I will come back to that. It is important for the department to be transparent, accountable, and collaborative with the community as we develop the program and improve the program that currently exists. We stipulate that in the past we have not done a good job with this program, and it is our intent and our commitment to improve this program. And so we have developed a workforce development group that has involved membership from all of those agencies and groups that are listed on this page. And you can see we have tried to incorporate, we've got contractors there, we've got community groups, we've got DBEs, we've got all sorts of folks there, because we believe the only way to get a good solution that brings about significant change and is sustainable is to have all the partners at the table as we move towards a program that will provide and meet the needs for all of the stakeholders in this area. So what we've done is identified some areas of change already. Since December, this group has gotten together and identified these areas where we need to focus on and improve so that we can build a better program. And the very first one is consequences for lack of good faith efforts. But we feel without a strong program, it's difficult to hold those consequences. So we're in the process of building this program so that we can hold contractors accountable for meeting those. But more importantly, we want to build the DBE resource to that group. We want to, the DBE and employment. So we want to provide training. We want to come up with ways that we can build a bigger pool to draw from for those contractors. One of the ways we intend to do that is we've created a program for reimbursing mentoring costs for the contractor. We're setting up a new DBE bidding process where in the past we used to ask for DBE goals after the letting. Now we're going to create a process that asks for DBE goals on the date of the letting. And if those DBE goals don't show good faith effort and compliance with or good faith towards the goals that were set, we will not deliver that contract, will not award that contract. And we've also brought DBEs into the electronic bidding to bring them to a level playing field. We also are going to set our public, we're going to have a public environment in order to set these goals so everybody understands how we're coming to those numbers. We've got a managed working capital fund for short-term loans for DBEs in order to help them manage administering their project with limited capital. We're providing training for workers so that they can come to the contractors with the skills needed to perform at a level that will be beneficial for both. And we're going to track this program. We're going to be transparent, just as we're trying to be today, about how we're going to meet these goals. Most of all, though, the department is absolutely committed. Commissioner Sorrell, myself, and our Office of Civil Rights is fully committed to moving in the direction that will work for all, again, all of the stakeholders. Just quickly cover the DBE, or the economic stimulus package, because when in the group we met last Friday, there was a lot of concern by our workforce development group that we're going to be busy creating this new program and the economic stimulus will pass us by and those opportunities, and we don't want to allow that to happen, and we're not going to allow that to happen. And so we've acknowledged that there and are communicating the fact that there's $20 million available for bonding for DBEs and for DBE specified in the law itself in the economic stimulus. Also $20 million for the workforce development. We recognize that we need to take steps today so that DBEs and minorities and women can play a role in delivering this great economic stimulus package that was passed this week. And so we are going to be incorporating mentoring requirements on appropriate projects in those that we are identifying for the economic stimulus. And we're setting aggressive goals for those projects that have work that are typically performed by DBEs. So we're not going to stand back and live the way we used to live in the civil rights area. We are trying to take steps right now, but again, more importantly, we are trying to build a strong program that will work for us not only next month, but in 10 years. And we'll meet the needs for all of the stakeholders. And with that, we'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay. Members, there are several folks from the community that also would like to testify. So what I'd like to do is, if you have any questions right now for Mr. Arsenault, let's get those out on the table, and then we'll have some people from the community with their testimony. So we'll start with Representative Champion.
Sir, you indicated that a part of your new approach is that you're looking to make sure that there's training available for DBEs. It's my understanding in 2007-2008 that a part of the grad engineering program that you all spent roughly $3.2 million. And that was to educate how many people?
Mr. Chair and Representative Champion, I believe that was 31 people.
So $3.2 million is spent to educate 31 people. And it is also not true, in the same year, you all spent for three programs, the OJT program, the ROADS program, and another one abbreviated TOTP, which you can talk about what that is. You spent a total of how much?
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, I'm not sure on that. We can get that information.
It appears from your report that there was $229,000 spent. And do you know, I'm sure that I think Hope Jensen is the liaison. Can you tell us how many people were served when we look at the OJT program, ROADS, and the other third program aggregated together?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, two things that I need to say about this. First, to answer your question, Representative Champion, we served a total of 430 people through the remaining programs. I must address that the grad engineer program includes the salaries of the engineers that participate in that program, which would account for a great deal of the monies that are put out in that program.
Can I follow up?
Yes, the Representative Champion.
Whereas the other programs do not include the salaries of the staff.
And just so that I'm clear, I just want to make that I'm clear, because I would like the committee to be clear. So you all spent $3 million more for 31 people, correct? Because if I'm looking at those numbers...
My understanding is, and I didn't bring the report with me, and I should have, I apologize for that, but we had approximately half as much money spent on the individual programs where we employ women and minorities. Now, in the programs as we operate them, did not include the salaries of the participants. In other words, OJT, what you see as the dollar amount that's included in the report, was what we paid a community organization to recruit and train to place on the MnDOT project. We did not include the salary amount of that individual once he was placed on the project. That is my error. I received the numbers for the grad engineer program from our HR department and did not understand that they had included salary in that. It should not include salary. So I will get you a corrected number for that. I do understand, though, that it does show that we have spent more on our engineers than we have spent on our high school programs and our, what we call the SEEDS program to bring young people into MnDOT.
And now it's my understanding that you have talked about enforcement if someone is not in compliance with the goals or meeting the goals. What sort of enforcement are you going to do in the future? And also, have you ever enforced someone who has been in non-compliance? Have you ever done anything, disciplined them? Anyone that has not ever been in compliance?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we do have contractually sanctions that are placed in our contract. I'll have to take the disadvantaged business piece separately from the employment piece. We have, during the 3 years that I've been in this position, we have placed sanctions on two contractors for non-compliance with the DVE program. And in the OJT area, it's a little more complicated because we cover both state employment laws and federal employment laws. The OJT program is a federal program that applies to our contracts that have federal funds, but we also administer the state Department of Human Rights program that sets specific goals that we must achieve on our project. So in other words, we have a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Human Rights that gives us guidance as to how we are to apply those sanctions when our contractors fail to use good faith efforts. And I must say, good faith efforts is a term that comes to us from the federal law. We did not make that term up, so that's the term you will hear used because it comes out of the federal law.
And just so clear, so there's only two people, two companies that's ever been sanctioned in the 3 years that you've been around?
Yes.
And when did you...
That's fine. Go ahead.
And when did you first start with MnDOT?
I started with MnDOT, and I held many jobs within MnDOT. I started in this position on December 14, 2005.
Thank you. Representative Hausman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think just a general comment first. Obviously, just by attendance in the room today, you can see there is this huge interest in the answers to these questions. And I think some of that began when people began to be aware of the federal statutes that suggested there are federal dollars, percentage of federal dollars that a state might spend on all the activities that we've been talking about today. And we even put some language that the department was cooperative with. And I think after some time, people begin to wonder about outcomes and accountability. But it takes on special emotion right now because we read in the newspaper that there is a huge infusion of federal money intended to put people to work. Mm-hmm. And I think the emotion around the day and the questions have to do with will it put everyone to work equally? Will everyone have equal opportunities for those jobs? And we hope there are many that those federal stimulus dollars provide. I heard the answer to Representative Champion, but but maybe definition would be helpful. When he asked about the consequences for lack of good faith effort, and you said there were sanctions, I'm not sure what the sanctions were. Did we get? I was late, and so maybe there was a discussion about that. But what are the sanctions,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hausman? The sanctions are given to us by the federal regulations. We are the first sanction that can be placed on a contract is that it's not awarded. So if at the point of prior to award, my office takes a look at the participation level that contractor comes forward with and feels it is inadequate, given all the other regulations we must look at, we then make a recommendation to our department not to award that contract. Then secondly, if at the end of the contract, where we monitor them throughout, but if at the end of the contract we find that the contractor did not comply with the commitment that they made to utilize both minority and women workers and minority and women subcontractors, we then are allowed to sanction them up to the amount that they failed to utilize.
So in the case, I think you said there have been two companies sanctioned?
Right.
In either case, did they lose the contract? Did you discover it before and you didn't award the contract? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, no. We have a required process that we must go through if we are going to recommend not to award a contract. There has to be and this is through federal law again, what they call a reconsideration hearing, and we have had several of those where the contract was awarded. Mine is a recommendation.
Okay. Thank you very much, members. I don't see any additional members who have indicated that they have questions for MnDOT. So what I'd like to do is thank you to Ms. Jensen, Mr. Arsenault, and I'd like to call on several members from the public who have indicated an interest in testifying. Reverend Paul Slack, Reverend Jerry McAfee, Al McFarlane is here, so I don't know if you wanted to testify individually or as a team. Whatever you'd prefer to do is fine with us. So.
I think it would be helpful if we could testify individually.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein and representatives of this oversight committee. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Reverend Paul Slack. I am the pastor of New Creation Church in Brooklyn Park, and I am also a member of the Isaiah organization. And of course, many of you are aware that we work out of faith for justice in the state of Minnesota. We have nearly 100 churches in the metro area and in the St. Cloud that are members of our organization. Isaiah is also a member of Gamaliel, through which we work for justice on a national level. And we are here because we are committed to racial and economic justice, because we believe that everyone deserves access to living wage jobs and an opportunity to rebuild their lives and community. We believe that the only way to achieve the racial and economic justice that we advocate for is through transformational relationships, where we come up out of our silos and work across issues and disciplines to achieve justice for all Minnesota residents, and indeed a greater and stronger Minnesota. In regards to the Minnesota Department of Transportation, we're working for public and transparent processes with a vision for a better reality than what exists in the Department of Transportation and the highway heavy construction industry. Many of you have heard this morning that testimony has been given. There is some intention that are present and some good faith, but I'd like to come back to that point about the meaning of those two words in a bit. Chair Hornstein, we want a workforce that reflects the demographics of Minnesota, and we support DBE goals that are aggressive and results that mirror the goals. I understand that the Department of Transportation cannot shoulder all of the responsibility for inclusion of minorities, women, and low income, but the workforce in the transportation industry is a part of the solution. We know that demographics in Minnesota is constantly changing, but contrary to trends while the trends are going one way, the reality in the workforce in the Minnesota Department of Transportation is going the other way and becoming less and less diverse. We'd like to know what strategies is the department taking to reverse this unacceptable trend. Some suggest there's nothing that we can do about this reality. We just have to accept it. Some suggest there's nothing, that this is an impossibility. But we can't look at it that way. We have to look at what happened when we talked about safety and when we resurrected the policy of zero death. Some people thought that that was impossible. But when we raised that high expectation, what we saw resulted was drastically reduced deaths in this state and in this department. We can also look at the EPA standards and the results that have been produced there. The standards that were set when they were initially set, some people thought that they were too high. But look at the drastic and dramatic results that we've achieved by establishing high expectations. We want to know whether the Department of Transportation is going to have strategies, what those strategies are, to produce real results and not just intentions. With you here today, we hope to create that kind of atmosphere, the same kind of atmosphere that exists for zero deaths, the same kind of atmosphere that exists for EPA standards. It ought to be the same for inclusion in workforce and DBE participation, not just goals. When we reviewed the report sent to this body, 7 contractors were said to be out of compliance. You heard about that a minute ago. None of those contractors were named. Will there come a time when the Department of Transportation will create the kind of transparency that names the contractors? The corrective actions taken and the results of those corrective actions. Not just that there were actions, but that the actions yielded some real results for inclusion. Are there contractors that are habitually out of compliance? And what has been done about them? Perhaps I suffer from a little bit of confusion, but I thought I heard nothing a minute ago. We want inclusion goals to be just as important as safety goals and a contractor coming in on budget. We know what happens there. We know that the transportation budget will be doubled this year because of the stimulus package. We want to know what the Department of Transportation is doing now to take advantage of this opportunity and create a pilot program on training. Ultimately, I don't want to be mistaken, we want MnDOT to create an environment that works for all Minnesotans. But we also want to know what the Department of Transportation is doing right now to take full advantage of the opportunity that is before us. Some people say that there are too many restrictions to use the stimulus money. Well, I offer a suggestion. Take a percentage of the regular budget. Take a full percentage of the regular budget and use that percentage, since the budget is going to be doubled, use that percentage to create training programs that work for people who have been disenfranchised. We ought to be able to find a way now to produce better results. In the stakeholders meeting that MnDOT is hosting, there is great intent. But frankly, intent is not enough. Good faith is not enough. If I can quote my mother, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Bernie, Mr. Arsenal has publicly acknowledged that MnDOT's record for inclusion is woefully lacking. I believe he wants to do well, but I also believe that the environment in MnDOT has to be transformed. Not just Mr. Arsenal, but the Minnesota Department of Transportation itself needs to be transformed, and we need to co-create a new way of doing business that produces results and inclusion. We have to develop that. It needs to happen. Not tomorrow, not waiting for a new day, but right now. Someone may say, what about all the people who are recently out of work? I think the national stats is 7% unemployment. For African Americans, it's double figures, 12 and below, above. The case for African Americans and many other people of color is even more dismal than everybody else. So what about those people who are recently out of work? African Americans and other people of color have chronically been out of work for decades. What are we going to do now with this new opportunity to create the kind of atmosphere and results that we all need to create together for a better future in Minnesota? Where will we invest in people of color who have been chronically out of work? Invest now so that we're all in crisis. Invest right now since we're all in crisis so that we can all rise out of this crisis together. Let's commit today to co-create a better pathway than what has been. We need public, transparent, and transformative policy. We do expect big things. We also deserve big things. I want to thank you for this environment that you're beginning to set right now. And I want to make my pledge and our pledge of Isaiah that is here present in the room today. We've been leading in this process for 5 years. We are going to continue to work until we see a different result, not just a different intention. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to thank Reverend Sachs for your testimony, and I also wanted to thank Isaiah for the leadership role you've played in this. And as someone who's done community organizing in the past, I know how hard it is to turn out large numbers of people for public meetings, particularly in the middle of the day. And I think it echoes Representative Hausman's statement that people don't turn out to the Capitol like this unless the issue is very heartfelt and very immediate. And so that's why we did the hearing today. Does the committee have any questions for Reverend Slack? Okay. Yes, Representative Portman.
I just should want to let the committee know that he's my constituent, and I'm really glad that he's here today and warmly welcoming him.
Thank you, Representative Portman.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you again very, very much for your testimony.
Thank you
for being
here
and for your hard work on this. Yes, welcome to the committee. Mr. King.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, sir. I would first, Mr. Chair, like to thank you and Representative Hoffman for your leadership in arranging this hearing, and certainly Representative Hoffman's leadership in the last 2 years to get us to this point. I would also like to first introduce myself. I'm Lewis King, President and CEO of Summit Academy OIC, and also the co-chair, along with Will Steger, of the Hire Minnesota campaign. And at Hire Minnesota, we believe in three things. First, the best social service program in the world is jobs. Next, we organize across boundaries. You can look around the room and see the myriad of people that we have. And we have environmentalists, community activists, and just plain old country boys like myself trying to get it done. The third thing that we believe in is to, as the sign say, be prepared and be heard. I know that you get a lot of people coming in front of you asking for a lot of things. So I thought that I would first establish a common bond, and that is, as a leader, you've been elected to represent the interests of all the people of Minnesota, even though you come from districts. And when I practice leadership here in Minnesota, I try not to simply represent the interests of one community, because I understand that we're all in this thing together. And that is a lesson and a commitment that I bring 27 years of experience, starting first as an Army officer. And during that time, I could not choose which troops I led or which families I cared for. They all counted on me for leadership. And at the end of the day, it was my job to bring them home safely and make sure they were taken care of. And that is the spirit that I bring to this table. There are a few things that I hold up as principles about leadership. The first is that silence is consent. If we know that something is going on and we don't say anything about it, then we say it that it's okay. The second thing that I learned is that if we walk past a piece of paper and we don't stop and pick it up, correct the answer, the problem, we set a new standard and say that it's okay again. And the third thing is we have to lead by example. So people are watching us, and we have to be careful, not necessarily always about the things that we say, but the things that we do. And that is why I'm here today, because I really appreciate Mr. Arsenault and his goodwill and his well intentions. But we cannot escape the record. And in order to really understand where we're starting from, we must move away from qualitative good faith efforts and deceptions and focus on hardcore quantitative facts. So I've given you packets, and I'm going to walk you briefly and very rapidly through a discussion that will center on the facts. Next, please. The problem statement. It is obvious, as Mr. Arsenault has stated, that MnDOT has inadequate minority recruiting and training programs. It is clear that contractors do not follow the rules on hiring goals or DBE. MnDOT does not adequately enforce the hiring goals, and until now, the legislature has not held this agency accountable. That's the only explanation for how this has been allowed to go on for so long. And we take our responsibility as the people, because we probably haven't shown up like this or been at it for 5 years. And I want to thank my friends from Isaiah, because of their stick-to-itness. And now we're at the point of contact, and we will see this thing through. Next, please. In the report, which I do have a copy of, the MnDOT sentence, in its overview, it says, as a leader in the transportation industry, the Minnesota Department of Transportation, MnDOT, looks for innovative ways to recruit employees and contractors from all of Minnesota's diverse population. That is a statement from the first page of the report, and I will bring you back to that later. Next, please. Second, recruitment, training, skill improvement programs are meant to help them develop a strong pipeline of minority and women employees, and to recruit business people as well, and DBE. Next. How it works. The Office of Civil Rights, and this is very important, sets project-specific goals in the form of a specific number of bodies and hours on all federally funded MnDOT projects over $1 million in over 100 days. That would be the office headed by Ms. Hope Jensen, who was sitting here previously. And they pay contractors $3 an hour for their OJT trainees in a way of subsidizing their wages. And they pay $1 for those who were not graduates of the Rhodes Program. Next. In their report, the first thing they say is that it is their responsibility to set the goals. That is stated on page 2. But they never say how many projects qualify for these goals over the biennium. What were the budget amounts for these projects? What was the performance of each project against the goals? And did MnDOT have an overall minority hiring goal for the period? And did it actually accomplish its goal? And nowhere in the report that they submitted to you did they state those facts. They merely stated that they were required to set the goals. So that's like the old proverbial, I'm going to lose weight deal. But not how many pounds. And then at the end of the day, we don't ask the question, how did you do? It was just my job to say I was going to lose weight. Next. The adult training program consists of three areas. OJT, which they describe, and I would say that trainees are allowed to work up to 2,000 hours in these programs. There is next is the Rhodes program, where they actually bring people in to be a feeder to the OJT. Then there's the Transportation Opportunities Training Program. And finally, the Graduate Engineer and Land Surveyor Program, please. The OJT program, as stated previously, is a federally mandated program meant to be a gateway for people to get into the heavy construction program. Next. The roads program is supposed to serve as a feeder into OJT. So the two theoretically work together, and it's important that you understand this mechanism. The transportation programs are developed as a method of providing fully qualified, diverse candidates for employment with highway heavy construction contractors or with MnDOT maintenance. Well, in the report, it states that 42 road participants graduated from the program. It never states how many of them were actually hired onto jobs or got into the OJT program. In fact, it goes on and it talks about the number of people trained in the transportation program, but again, does not give MnDOT any credit for how many were hired. And I must tell you, I'm not a DBE person, disadvantaged business enterprise. I'm a workforce developer. Amongst practicing professionals in my industry, if I take a contract from anyone, there are the following metrics that I'm held accountable for. How many people enrolled, how many graduated, how many were placed, what was their job retention, and ultimately, what were their wages. In the report delivered to you, Mr. Chair, none of those details are provided by MnDOT. Please. Next, there's the next section of the report focuses on the EEO or Equal Employment Opportunities Compliance Review. The office conducted 14 in-depth compliance reviews over the biennium. Now, again, it stated that if you got into this situation where you were placed on corrective action, in the second year you would be tracked to see how well you'd done. What was also not stated was that if you were out of compliance and you had corrective action, you could be referred to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights and your human rights certificate could be pulled. While 7 contractors were placed in corrective action status, 0 were referred to the Human Rights Department. It automatically raises the question, how many of them got into corrective action in 07 and were scraped by 08, meaning that they all got their act together, or how many of them started in 08 and are now moving into 09 in a review period? Further, there are no names about who these people were or who these contractors were and what were their specific violations. This is the Graduate Engineering Land Surveyor Program is the most interesting thing I've come across in quite some time. I will say that it is a program for current MnDOT employees, and that reads directly from page 7 of the report that Ms. Jensen prepared and provided to you. The language is verbatim. It's designed to provide the graduate engineer training with practical work experience through formal job rotations once they are hired at MnDOT. So, at the onset, we stated that the training programs were used to bring people into MnDOT. But here you're going to find, as Representative Champion talked about earlier, a huge, vast, disparate proportion of the resources dedicated to MnDOT employees. Next. Here are some financial facts. 254 individuals participated in the Adult Highway Heavy Workforce Training Program, and $229,000 was expended on these 3 programs. MnDOT paid $10,000, or 2% for all hours worked for the 170 participants in the OJP program. Now, this is phenomenal. Given that if all 42 road graduates made it into the OJP program, that means 128, the contractors got off the street, or 75% of the people were reimbursed for $1. Therefore, MnDOT reimbursed $7,500 for 128 people and $2,500 for 42 people. If you do the math on that, it averages out to about 59 hours per person while they're eligible to work for up to 2,000.
Excuse me, Mr. King.
Yes, sir.
We're getting some feedback on the mic. That means there's probably someone around the table using a cell phone or in the room even.
So if someone is, please turn off cell phones or other electronic devices so we can make sure that Mr. King's testimony is very clear on the public record, because we want to have a clear public record of this meeting. So I apologize, Mr. King, for that, but please turn off any electronic devices you may have. You can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The total expenditure for these programs for the 192 participants was $549,000, or roughly double what they spent on adults, and that's fine. Kids need career exploration. The combined youth and adult programs came to $778,000 for 446 participants. And this is the numbers that are in your report. The Graduate Engineer and Land Surveyor program had a total of 55 participants over a two-year period with the combined annual budget of $3.3 million. 55 people had salaries paid of $3.3 million, while the department spent $778,000 on 446 people. When you take this and you strip the kids out and you just look at the adult side, MnDOT spent a total of $3.4 million. And the majority of that, as you'll see in the next slide, was on the engineers. This bar graph shows you that it's really tough to see that the OJT program had about $10,000, the roads at $53,000, and then you got the transportation program. And the one that sticks out is the money that was spent on the engineers. It's a single bar that you see standing straight up, and then to the right of it, the youth program. It's not even close when you display it graphically. Next. When you just combine the adult programs, and that is the engineers versus the adults, over 90% of the dollars are spent on the engineer training program versus the all the other programs combined. Here's another way to look at it, too, that within the engineer program, 80% of the participants are white male, 9% are minorities, and 11% females. That's 44, 5, and 6 respectively. Again, the comparison between what's spent on the engineers who are employees of MnDOT and all the other adult programs, 93% to 7%, or again, the $229,000 versus the $3.3 million. So this begs several questions in terms of transparency and comparison of expenditures versus the stated purpose of the training program. How can the department expect to recruit and train a diverse workforce when over 90% of the adult training funds are spent on existing employees? How does the agency justify this grossly disparate investment in existing employees when the stated purpose of the funding is to bring in diverse workers? How can the agency claim to support the efforts of contractors to hire minorities and women when it expends such a small percentage of its available training dollars on recruiting potential employees? So what we're getting at here is that if we follow your edit that show me how you spend your money, and I'll tell you what your priorities are, this begs the question of the opening statement made in the report to you, because the expenditures do not follow the stated priorities. Next. DDE. In short, 67% and 61% of projects over the biennium were not in compliance for disadvantaged business enterprises. 67% and 61%. Further, when you look at the FHWA and the FTA performances, and they were 8.2 and 7.0 respectively in the biennium. They declined to 3.7 and 3.785 in 2008. So we trended in the wrong direction. Again, this is straight from the report that was given to you in the DBE section. This raises several questions. Let's take the percentages and put them aside, because that gets too clinical. How much money did this cost people is the question. What was lost? How many projects made up to 67 and 61% non-compliance? And it stated in the report that there was one firm in the biennium that was actually sanctioned and received the sole $200,000 sanction. And we like to know, I think the public deserves to know who that was, because they're probably still doing business with the agency. so there's a decline in the FDA and FHWA performance as well, and that needs to be explained. Even though you had the bridge occurring, here's the picture that's painted in the report. And finally, why should the public believe? Why should the public believe that the agency is acting on the behalf of all Minnesotans and in our best interest? There is nothing quantitatively stated in this report that suggests that we can simply overlook the past and take some vague promises presented in a three-page overview to you today, when the 12-page report demonstrates that this agency simply does not have the wherewithal to deliver on the promise. Therefore, we're making several recommendations. Increase accountability. Amend the law to require quantitative results according to the legislature. This type of report, I just say with all due respect, I did this kind of work when I was in about the ninth grade. You gotta bring it all the way, and we shouldn't have to dig for the information. It should be fully transparent. Increase transparency. Require the agencies to establish a website that reports the quantitative information and contract performance to the public on a monthly basis. In some places, you can see what people are in jail for. You can go there and actually look to see who's in jail for what. Why should we be able to see how this large agency is performing with tax dollars here in the state of Minnesota? We asked for a modest investment of $4 million. We asked for a modest investment of $4 million. So they got $20 million. We really want to see them put it on the table so that we can develop a robust recruitment and training pipeline that follows principles accepted by practicing professionals. Require mandatory training of prime contractors on higher regulations of DBE participation and consequences of noncompliance. When you read their good faith efforts in the report, they all focus on the DBEs and minority communities. There was no mention of what they actually sit down with the contractors and talk about. And if the door swings both ways, you got to expend some effort there. Invest more dollars in compliance officers to increase performance, like you put more state troopers and more police on the streets when things are important to get people to comply with the law. I've heard this office complain that they don't have enough people. When you pin them against the wall, they'll then say, well, we don't have enough people. Well, let's invest in more people so that we can get the law enforced. Establish a community oversight committee that is independent of MnDOT. With all due respect, I have one of my people at the table with this thing that's going on that they're doing right now. And let me just say this to you. It does not pass my smell test. There is no rigor. There has been no quantitative discussion. And right now, construction season, the contracts are happening now. And in the background, these group discussions and processing are taking place, and we will not stand on the sideline this construction season and see this money go away. Finally, and I'll get out your hair, we believe that it is appropriate for this MnDOT to establish a 25% minority hiring goal for the stimulus package. There'll be $500 million spent in the state of Minnesota. In your packet, I've given you a breakout. They project that 12,000 jobs will be created. In the metro, they project that 7,000 jobs will be created. We're asking for this agency to step up and ensure that 1,800 people get to go to work on the project. That will be 25%. State, if you put that in the whole pool, that's 10%. And given where we've been down the pipeline before, and the fact that money's been taken out of these people's pockets for so many years, this is not an unreasonable request. Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present to the committee today. Again, I appreciate your efforts and your leadership. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I make sure that we can get through our agenda members, I think what we're going to do here is we have several people from the community that have signed up to testify. We're going to get through their testimony, and it's my understanding there's some folks that came in from out of town to testify in our next bill. So what we're going to make sure that we do that bill this evening at 6 because we have a very crowded agenda already for next week.
and we had a big, very interested group from the public today, so we want to make sure that they're accommodated. We want to make sure that the out-of-town testifiers for House File 690 are accommodated. And so at this point, it looks like we're going to be, barring anything unusual here, meeting at 6 o'clock this evening in Room 5 to continue our hearing. So if you could please identify yourself for the record, the remaining testifiers, if you could be as to the point as possible, because we have to be out of this room in about 15 to 20 minutes. We want to take your testimony, but please be as brief as possible. And Representative Houseman.
Mr. Chair, because we were just referencing the packet, and he may have mentioned it, but I may have missed it, lest any of us think this is not possible, the sheets on the Minnesota Twins ballpark project show amazing outcomes. So it shows on it with one company on one project that is going forward. There really are quite incredible goals, and they have arrived where they need to be. So it just seems to me that was worth mentioning.
Thank you, Representative Houseman. And Representative Champion.
I just want to acknowledge that I'm thankful to have Seminole IC here, and they are in my district, so I want to welcome them here as well.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl, I think that's good that you identified it. We want to just get through our agenda here, so Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just real quickly, you know, I don't mean to dampen the enthusiasm of everyone here or the encouragement, but just would like to remind the folks here that you know, the proper etiquette of committee and this the body of the House of Representatives is that we don't cry out things, we don't applaud, we don't cheer. I mean, it may seem like a sporting event or a contest or something, but it really isn't. And just want to put that reminder out there.
Okay, with that, and I appreciate that, Representative Earl. I do, again, I think, want to get through making sure that everyone who came has a chance to speak. And so we have, I believe, Reverend McAfee and Al McFarland.
Yes, I'm Reverend Jerry McAfee. I'm pastor of New Salem Missionary Baptist Church. I'm also the president of the Minnesota State Baptist Convention. I represent 41 churches, as well as a member of His Works United, which is the State Churches of God in Christ, Pentecostal Assemblies of the World, as well as AMEs, and we also represent over 100 and some churches. First off, to my brother, and I heard this word mentioned before in reference to emotion. I think it would be sad to mistake us solely being emotional. Our emotion is predicated, platform, pinnacled, and perched from a premise of intellect. From pain, of constant and consistent being ignored, and perhaps when etiquette was written, it was written without our culture being established or involved. So when one see us clap, that is not that we think that we are in a sporting event. That basically suggests that we're in affirmation of what has been spoken, and because we cannot adequately articulate nor say what is on our minds and our hearts, we clap. Now, that being said, to the members of the community, if you would be so kind, since we are in their house right now, but if you give us time, we can get it changed so we can be more welcome. If we would hold our applause, I would appreciate it. But I do love it. I'm a Baptist preacher. If there was one phrase that perhaps captures the essence of what I heard, is highway robbery. I say highway robbery because when one looks at the goals that have been established and the goals that have not been met, when one looks at the prison population that we have, and we understand the connection and the correlation between poverty and lack of employment, when we look at this, it is atrocious. The I-35W bridge has been rebuilt, but the London Bridge in our community is down. I have absolutely, positively, no hope, desire, or trust in a system that has not been right except for one time in 8 years. Now, first off, let me apologize to you all. Why would I do that? Because if you all spend the time that you spend, the long hours that you do,
to come up with these different laws and stuff that you might govern the totality of the state. You don't have the time to always oversee everything. Part of my role as a pastor, preacher, teacher is to blow the trumpet and sound the alarm. And as quiet as it's kept, when it has come to MnDOT, we have not quieted out. We have not brought to your attention the atrocities that have been taking place. So let me apologize to you all, and some of us, we probably ought to go to jail for in violation of the Good Samaritan law. Because when you see the pathway to the prison, and I go through the community and I can see signs held up, it don't take a PhD to hold up a sign for $18 an hour. Not at all. Here's what I'm asking you for. Even before another pothole is filled, the Department of Transportation, the Minnesota in particular, it just about needs to be put in receivership until we know that some things are going to happen. You all know, if you did your job the way MnDOT has done theirs, you wouldn't be in office. You would not be in office. And for the dollars that have gone through hands over the years, they know who one of the leading culprits is. I'll say it if nobody else will. Ames Construction got a history of noncompliance. But yet, they are one of the largest gatherers of MnDOT dollars, and I'll guarantee if you go through those contracts that they get rid of, I bet you their names is in there as well. I'm asking for something more forceful. I agree with Lewis them. Thank God for Michael, Pastor Slack, and we all work together. I'm asking for something different. I think the money ought to be held up. Hold it up until we got something that works. Right now, this thing ain't working for us, and we need your help. Our prisons are too full. Our people are dying at alarming rates. And I ask you, whatever you, help us. And I'll guarantee you this. You'll see us again. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, members. Thank you, Reverend McAfee. Please proceed and identify your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I am Al McFarlane. I am the editor and owner of Insight News, host of a radio broadcast called Conversations with Al McFarlane, convener of meetings in the community talking about economic development, health, politics, culture, etc. The reason I wanted to testify simply was to encourage transparency and honesty. One of the items that came to my attention was that the department claims it has made contact with the ethnic media to communicate its goals, its priorities, and it gives the suggestion that there has been some kind of involvement with Insight News, it actually named, and other ethnic media. And I'm simply here to say that there has been no contact with Insight News. I probably would be willing to say there has not been formal contact with the ethnic press of Minnesota. Having said that, we simply want to let you know the Minnesota Multicultural Media Consortium does exist. It consists of the Black, Asian, Latino, and Native American press in Minnesota, and we stand ready to assist and support you and the department in communicating the values, the goals, explaining the opportunity, and encouraging civic engagement, public buy-in, support for the work of MnDOT.
Thank you, Mr. McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Bill English, co-chair of the Coalition of Black Churches African American Leadership Summit. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. By way of background, I'm qualified to speak on these issues involved here today because of my experience and training in matters of equal employment opportunity, DBE program, and affirmative action issues and programs. For more than 17 years, I served as Vice President of EEO and Affirmative Action for Controlled Aid and Labor Civilian, both companies nationally recognized for the advances made in those areas. Both were large federal contract providers and required by regulation to comply with various statutes. We are too are grateful to IZEA as an organization for pushing the legislature to require reporting by MnDOT. However, the report before you today is disgraceful, not only in its content, which is at best elementary, but in what it does not include. As a body, you should demand better reports and hold MnDOT to a level of excellence in compiling such a report. We know MnDOT is more capable of better reporting, We think it is deceptive that over the years that they have consistently treated with disdain and contempt is the problem. If those are considered harsh words, one needs only to examine the lack of progress MnDOT has made over the years in the areas of minority employment, the use of DBEs, and non-discrimination. For example, during the 494 highway construction project recently, MnDOT set a goal of $18 million for minority and women-owned business. I have been told that the final results were less than $6 million. This means they missed their mark by more than $13 million that could have been used to increase minority and women employment and contracting on a large MnDOT project. Can you imagine for a moment what $13 million would have done for these businesses and the people they might have employed? The bigger question is, why did MnDOT allow their contractors to miss the mark by that margin and not hold them more accountable for results? It is a consistent practice for MnDOT to allow its large providers to set minimal goals and then not achieve them and be rewarded with larger, more lucrative contracts. There is no penalty in spite of state law that MnDOT feels obligated to enforce. That, in our view, is corrupt. We call on this legislature first of all, before the end of the session, to require MnDOT to be totally transparent in the results or lack thereof in their efforts to date. More importantly, this body must demand that MnDOT set aggressive but reasonable and achievable goals as been done by other jurisdictions. For example, Representative Hausman, the Minneapolis Convention Center, the Minneapolis Public Library, and the Excel Center were all model projects where employment goals and DBEs utilization goals were achieved. More recently, the new Twin Stadium in Minneapolis is demonstrative of success where there is the will and the commitment of the agency and the contractor. In the latter instance, the success achieved is by Martinson and the Ballpark Authority. Finally, as we approach the several $1 billion likely to come to Minnesota under the stimulus package for infrastructure, we cannot allow MnDOT to administer these funds in the fashion they have in the past. We, the Coalition of Black Churches African American Leadership Summit, will ask Senator Klobuchar, Congressman Ellison, and Congressperson McCollum to cause funds to be withheld until MnDOT demonstrates the ability to achieve aggressive goals, operate transparently, and enforce the laws already on the books to achieve the desired results. I need to inform this committee that African Americans contribute more than $3.3 billion annually in Minnesota to the economy and pay more than $500 million in taxes, including gasoline taxes. Yet we are unable, for the most part, to work on MnDOT projects or participate as subprime contractors. It is not because we do not have qualified workers that can be and interested in training opportunities. That is evidenced by the projects that were successful that I mentioned earlier. Failure to act on your part will require us to bring legal action against MnDOT, to request the U.S. Civil Rights Commission to investigate MnDOT, and to use peaceful and nonviolent protest, including shutting down infrastructure projects with bodies and vehicles if necessary, to bring public scrutiny on the failure of MnDOT and its major providers to guarantee equal opportunity and equal contracting opportunities to communities of color and women-owned businesses in Minnesota. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Pastor English. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify?
Pastor English is not back.
Oh, okay. Thank you. We have one more person that wishes to testify, but I think we have a question from Representative Mason.
I can take it at the end.
Okay. She'll defer till the end. So we will have one final testifier. Please identify your name for the record.
My name is William Means. I represent the Minnesota OIC State Council, which is a statewide training organization, education organization throughout the state with 5 training facilities. I'm here to make 2 strong points. You notice in the report from MnDOT regarding their hiring goals and how they met them that they call on last year as one of the years in which they are successful. However, all of us remember the building of the 35W bridge was done by an out-of-state contractor known as Flatiron Construction. So MnDOT itself had almost nothing to do with the fact that they made their own minority goals. It was handed to them by Flatiron Construction, who our job developers went and met with, who had a one of the women COOs on the job who actively sought out minority and women contractors and workers. That's all it takes. We've got a lot of organizations in the state that can provide well-trained employees without asking anybody to lower any standards. Finally, the next point I wanted to make that nobody mentioned today because we've been talking about federal. I want to talk about the gas tax that you all passed over the governor's veto. This has become a social justice issue now. Because when they passed the gas tax over the governor's veto, one of the selling points was that it would create 35,000 jobs a year for 5 years. So we're here to ask you, jobs for whom? We are physically capable of filling those jobs. You heard all the reasons why they're not filled. Transparency. You know, holding people accountable. But I just want to remind you that the gas tax, everybody pays in this room here. That's how they got here. And so we deserve to be included on the benefits of that gas tax. Not just the ability to ride on the road, but how about building the road? And how about seeing a few people, faces of color, on these projects as we drive around the metro area? That's all. Give our people the opportunity, and we got plenty of qualified workers. So I want to make that point with the gas tax belongs to all of us. And so please make sure that all of us are considered for these 35,000 jobs that the authors of the gas tax bill said would be placed in our communities every year for the next 5 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Members, before we recess, because we're not going to adjourn, we're going to recess till 6 o'clock, I wanted to give Representative Houseman or Representative Champion, who has been involved in this issue and helped put together the hearing today, maybe an opportunity to very briefly make any concluding comments, if they so wish.
Well, mine, Mr. Chair, was just to, I asked you for time on the agenda just last week and asked you could it be this week, and you complied, and it's not often one gets quite as pushy as that in terms of agenda, but I was grateful that you were able to provide the time on the agenda.
Thank you. President Kinsian.
First of all, Mr. Chair, let me say thanks also, because this issue has been near and dear to me, and from the very first day that I walked in this room, I've been talking about DBE inclusion and talking about the importance of fostering inclusion. Let me say this to all the folks that are here. I'm excited that they're here. It shows that they are interested in the process and that they're interested in fairness. And as we think about this committee, just so that the public will also know, that this is the Transportation Policy and Oversight Committee. And our charge is to make sure we are looking at everything that MnDOT is doing and making them accountable. And you have our commitment when we think in terms of, you know, working with MnDOT to make sure that there's increased transparency, because that's something that we heard them say today. We want to make sure that there's increased accountability, not just in what they say, but demonstrated in their actions. We also want to make sure that there's true investment when we think in terms of training. And Louis King and others who so eloquently talked about those things that's necessary in order to make sure that there's a true investment. And also, we want to make sure that the stimulus package does not come forward and, nor is implemented without there really being a clear vision around fostering inclusion. And I know that there are a couple people that did not have an opportunity to speak, but I would like to recognize them. I know that Richard Copeland is here. He's the national president for the National Association of Minority Contractors. I don't know if he's still here. I know he was here and he had to leave. I know that the local president is Mr. Jim Frisco. Also, Shell Morgan Spencer, who's from the Minneapolis Urban League. And I'm just naming some people because if I keep going, then I will forget someone. But the bottom line is that this committee is committed. The chair is committed. and we want you to remain engaged as we all work together in order to make sure that we foster inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Last word, and then we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to help us to learn a little bit more about an issue that I didn't know a lot about. But this does raise a lot of questions, Mr. Chairman, and I think, I don't know if Mr. Arsenault is going to answer the questions or someone else from MnDOT, but I would suggest that we have someone from MnDOT here again, and we can ask some of the questions that came up today.
Thank you, and that's a very good point to end on, Representative Earl, because this is not the end of the conversation. I believe it's the beginning of it. And so I think we're going to be hearing more from the community clearly. And certainly we have some questions for MnDOT, and they'll be responding to those. And as I said, I'd like to echo what Representative Campion said, that we're committed to working on oversight. That's our job. And the fact that so many people turned out and testified, I think, is a good beginning, and we're going to continue to work on this issue. Members, we stand in recess until 6 o'clock in Room 5. We'll be taking up House File 690. Oh, and members, please put the information about House File 690 in your folder so that they're not, so it's not taken away. Please put it in your folder. All right. With that, I will gavel our meeting to order. I really appreciate everybody coming back and everyone's patience and flexibility. It's certainly my intention to, again, allow for testimony, but within reason, we would like to get out hopefully between 7:30, something like that. But we'll make sure that people are succinct with their testimony, and I'll allow some flexibility with some of our earlier agreed-upon time limits, but I think we can get this done relatively quickly. So we have before us Representative Hortman's House File 690, and we'll have Representative Hortman move that bill to...
the Environment Policy Committee.
Okay. So the motion before us is to... pass and re-refer House File 690 to the Environment Policy and Oversight Committee. Welcome to your committee, Representative Hortman, and we'll take your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My hope is that you would abide pretty close to the guidelines that you gave me on time before, 15 minutes for proponents, 15 minutes for opponents, 15 minutes to questions. I think we should be able to get it done in that amount of time. This is a bill that was debated extensively last year. It is not different from last year's bill. It's in huge ways, the concept is the same. I know it's been lobbied intensively, so I'm guessing you all have spoken with multiple members of the lobbying community about the bill. And I think most people know how they're going to vote. So I would hope that we could present the information quickly and move to the vote within a reasonable amount of time. So, Mr. Chair, I will go very fast, members, and I will assume that you're going to keep pace with me. And if you have any questions, we can cover that. I have a handout in your packet. The first page of the handout is the 2008 Minnesota Statute 216.8.02. So that's the document that I'll be referencing as I speak during my part of setting up the bill. Mr. Chair, members, House File 690 is referred to as the Minnesota Clean Car Act. And what the bill does is it sets stricter vehicle emission standards for motor vehicles, passenger cars, light-duty trucks, and SUVs in Minnesota. There are two types of pollutants that it would make the standards more strict for. It would make the standard more strict for criteria air pollutants, which are a bunch of chemicals that come out of your tailpipes that have been regulated for a very long time under the Clean Air Act. But there's a new set of vehicle emission standards that would regulate the carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases from vehicles. And We, in 2007, set the standard of this state right here in 216-802, which is that we intended to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 15% below 2005 levels by 2015, 30% below 2005 levels by 2025, and at least 80% below the 2005 levels by 2050. We passed that on a very large bipartisan basis, and I would contend we didn't put that into law having no intention to reach those goals. Members, of course, the easy part is setting the goal. I want to weigh 125 pounds. That's an easy goal. It's getting to the goal that's the difficult part that requires the difficult action. On page 4 of this handout, there is a chart that explains where Minnesota is in its current greenhouse gas emissions. If you look in the upper right-hand corner, it references the number of... Is everybody getting the handout?
We're just getting...
Hopefully you put it in your page folder. The page that I'm referencing right now looks like this. And maybe I should be sitting at the one with the little... Let's do the little camera thing. Is this hard to turn on, the camera thing?
Yeah.
I just hit something that says display, right? How do we make the camera thing on? There you go. Is it open? Okay, the page that looks like this, folks. Right up here, it shows what's going to happen in Minnesota in 2025 if we do nothing. We will be emitting 200 million metric tons per year of carbon dioxide equivalent pollution. We did some good things in 2007. We set a renewable energy standard, and we also indicated a willingness to move to a higher biodiesel mandate and a higher ethanol mandate. Those actions will get us down to 162.6 million metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions a year. But in order to meet our goals, we need to get to 110. And so the challenge that we have, members, is how do we get from 162.6 million metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions in 2025 down to 110? We are going to have to take some action. There are a range of actions we can take. Some of them cost the state government a lot of money. Some of them cost consumers a lot of money. Fortunately for us, some of them save consumers a lot of money. There are some things that we can do that save consumers a ton of money. For example, if we were to set appliance efficiency standards, we could save consumers a ton of money. If we are to set stricter building codes so that new buildings and new homes use less energy to stay warm and stay cool, we can save people a lot of money. Clean cars is one of the alternatives before us that can save consumers a lot of money at the same time that it reduces carbon dioxide emissions. When you operate your motor vehicle, when you put gasoline in it, it emits 19 pounds of carbon dioxide every mile you go. When you're reducing carbon dioxide emissions from your vehicle, the easiest way to do that is to increase fuel economy for a car. And we know that the auto industry is capable of doing that. I'm going to show you on page 5, it shows you what a big percentage of the problem transportation. We worked on the electricity sector in 2007. If we don't do something about the transportation sector, we won't be solving the problem. Page 6 shows the trend lines of where we're going with our carbon emissions in the state of Minnesota. You can see that we have done a lot of things that start to get us towards decreasing the amount of carbon dioxide pollution we're putting into the atmosphere. But our goal that we set in statute is to go down. And so we have to take some bold and aggressive actions to begin moving down. On page 3, you'll see a comparison of the difference in reductions from the CAFE standard and the clean car standard. And what you'll notice is each year there's only a small difference. This is page 8 of the handout with the statute on the front. There's a little difference each year, but cumulatively that adds up to a big difference. So you will hear testimony later on that there's not much difference between the clean car standard and the CAFE standard. There is a difference, and over time it adds up to a lot. It's kind of the equivalent of me losing a pound a year, or you know, in 1 year that doesn't mean much, but in 10 years that starts to get you toward your goal.
Representative Holbert.
Can you tell me on page 8 what an LDV fleet is?
Light duty vehicle.
Oh, thank you.
On page 9, there's a summary of economic data compiled by an economics graduate student at the University of Minnesota of the net present value to a consumer purchasing a vehicle that's more efficient. The estimate is that these vehicles could add $1,000 to the cost of a car in 2016, but the operating cost for the vehicle will be reduced. So the net present value to the consumer ranges from $900 to $1,600 of having a more efficient car. Page 10 just gives you a scale. Japan and Australia are even more aggressive than the clean car standard. What I'm proposing to you today is not to adopt the most aggressive standard on the planet. What I included this chart to show you is the vehicles we're making now, if the auto manufacturers say they can't meet this standard, means they can't sell them in Australia and they can't sell them in Japan. And China's standards are even more rigorous than this. If you set aside the issue of global warming completely for a moment, say you don't believe in global warming, or say you think that there's nothing we can do and that as state leaders we don't have any responsibility to try, take a look at page 12, and that shows you the type of pollution that comes out of the tailpipe that causes asthma and aggravates asthma. And just ask yourself, if you are an asthma sufferer, if you want to breathe the level of crud indicated by the EPA Tier 2 standards, or whether you would want to breathe the level of crud that's indicated by the clean car standards. So if you take completely and set aside the issue of global warming, there's a significant public health reason to adopt the clean car standards. I think that the next page with the vehicle savings for a person is probably one of the most informative sheets in the packet. I know the graphs get maybe a little bit data heavy, but this kind of shows you in practical family budget perspective what the clean car standard would mean. The average person would be saving between $11 and $45 a month on their vehicle, assuming the cost goes up. Let's just assume that vehicles get more expensive. When you incorporate the monthly operating cost savings, a person would be saving from $11 to $45. Mm-hmm. And it's using this calculation that the governor's own climate change advisory group estimated if we were to adopt the clean car standard in Minnesota, it will save consumers $265 million between now and 2025. And how does it save people money? It saves people money on fuel. So when you go and fill up, if you're spending $36 to fill up your tank instead of $50, you have another $14 in your pocket that you can spend on other things. You can spend it at a Minnesota grocer. You can spend it at a Minnesota movie theater or a Minnesota retailer. There will also be people who will present testimony that this will be the end of E85 vehicles in Minnesota. I have worked on this bill, as you know, for over a year and had more than 15 meetings with the farm groups and the ethanol industry. And there is not a credible argument that this bill comprises any threat to the ethanol industry in Minnesota. I'm going to have you flip to the very, very last page. It is a bar graph showing the cost of changing motor vehicles to comply with pollution laws over the years. And you can see that the industry usually estimates that the cost will be quite significant. But then when the change is actually made, the cost is often very manageable for consumers. Catalytic converters. Lee Iacocca said it would destroy the auto industry. We cannot put catalytic converters on. It's too expensive. Said the same thing about seatbelts. But what we found was that it cost half of what the industry said that it would. And we reduced air pollution by so much from catalytic converters that we prevented between 100 and 300,000 premature births and between 10,000 and 30,000 children from being born with lower IQs. The Office of Management and Budget was directed to do a study of the Clean Air Act and look at the economic benefits to the United States of America. What they found was that the cost and benefits, the benefits outweighed the cost by about $5 trillion.
Representative Portman, I'm just getting a little conscious of time here, and I hope maybe if you could wrap up very shortly. I don't want to totally cut you off here, but just give you a little warning here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all the information I would like to present to you, and I would like to turn it over to Molly Schultz at this point.
Representative Horne, before you do that, I don't. You had indicated to me at one time that you were interested in an author's amendment. Are you not no longer interested in that? Or
Mr. Chair, we can do that now, if you'd like to.
I think it would be appropriate.
Mr. Chair, Matt Burrish drafted the author's amendment for me. When we drafted the bill, it was our intention to use existing definitions that were in Minnesota statute. And we did that, but he thought that there needed to be a little bit of cleanup. So this is fairly technical, and it doesn't change anything about the bill.
So in other words, Representative Portman, this is just clarifying some definitions, the A2 amendment?
That's what it is.
Okay. Is there any discussion, members, Representative Holbrook?
I had a question, I thought, from Matt Burris, but maybe Representative Portman. What is the difference of an all-terrain vehicle versus an off-highway vehicle as defined in Section 84.771?
I wish that Mr. Burris were here or that I had a copy of 84.771. But one thing that I can tell you, under federal law, we cannot regulate the emissions that come from ATVs. We cannot adopt a California standard. So we put some language in the bill to make people feel comfortable that we're never going to be extending this to chainsaws or motorcycles or lawnmowers or ATVs or snowmobiles or boats. But under federal law, we are barred from regulating those things. We're barred from adopting the California standard. So it's comfort language, but my understanding is all-terrain vehicles is not a term that we have defined in statute, and instead we call those off-highway vehicles.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might, so...
Representative Holbrook.
Is it your assessment that the amendment will subject less a number of vehicles to this standard, or...
It doesn't change the bill at all. It just references a different term for the same thing. Instead of referencing all-terrain vehicles, it references off-highway vehicles, but it has the same meaning. And if Mr. Burris has that wrong in some way, I'm happy to change it back in environment policy. But our intention is to exclude ATVs.
Representative Moyle?
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I would just have to be looking at 84.771 to document the same thing as Representative Holbrook. For the purposes of 84.771 to 84.79930, off-highway vehicle means off-highway motorcycle. Off-road vehicle is defined in another section, or an all-terrain vehicle as defined in the third section. And I'd be happy to pass down, Representative Holbrook.
Those of you who aren't aware, Representative Morrow has been trained as an attorney. So. Are there any other questions about the amendment while this is being mulled over? I want to make sure that Representative Holbrook is able to look at some of these definitions.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to assume that this is an amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like to dismiss the bill. I'm not trying to kill her amendment or anything. I'm just trying to understand.
Okay. No, I understand that. Is there any further discussion about the A2 amendment? Representative Portman moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Now the bill is in the shape that the author would like, and we have several testifiers. Ms. Schultz, you'll identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Molly Schultz, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. I'm here today on behalf of our coalition of more than 80 conservation and environmental organizations throughout the state, representing over 450,000 Minnesotans. Each year, our members choose a few issues that we believe rise to the level of having the full force of our coalition behind their passage. We call it our collaborative or priority agenda. In 2009, for the second year in a row, our members chose this bill to be part of our collaborative agenda. One of the things that we do when we choose our issues is we gauge public support. We were particularly interested in what we might find in our poll, as it was coming at the same time the auto industry bailout was reaching fever pitch in Washington, D.C. We wondered, would the public continue to support the adoption of these standards as strongly as they did in 2007? The answer is yes. 81% of Minnesotans agreed that by adopting these standards, we will increase pressure on the auto manufacturers to produce cleaner cars. That is 10% more than even those who agreed that these standards were important, were an important part of reducing global warming pollution. I wanted to see how this compared with last year's poll, and the result was exactly the same, 81%. Quite simply, if the auto industry is expecting widespread sympathy from Minnesotans, they couldn't be more wrong. The auto industry would like you to believe that having a state-by-state approach is too confusing and complex for them to manage, and that a national standard would be more to their liking. Well, history shows that the auto industry hasn't exactly embraced change on a federal level either. In fact, the arguments you hear today from the auto manufacturers are more of the same.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to interrupt, but Representative David made this point last night in another committee, and I think it's probably a good point to make here. Why don't we let the folks who are going to speak on behalf or against the bill speak their own words instead of having somebody else say them for them? Representative David made the point last night in the Commerce Committee that that was nice when somebody comes up and says what tells you what the other guys are going to say before they even have a chance to say it.
Representative Zellers, I believe that members of the public within their free speech rights, as long as the speech is not offensive or inaccurate, I think ought to be able to testify. I would, though, caution that we have some limited time,
mm-hmm.
and I would hope that the testimony could reflect that. But otherwise, the point well taken, but, you know, as long as the speech isn't offensive and completely inaccurate, I think we'll allow that. We can proceed.
Thank you. A review of industry positions shows a history of staunch opposition to even the most basic and now widely used safety standards. For example, General Motors had this to say about proposed airbag standards. Consumer resistance will be so great and the use of the restraints will be so low that the safety benefits will not justify the costs of this controversial regulation. Ford mounted a vigorous ad campaign opposing airbags, warning consumers of bogus consequences. Quote, driving along at 60 miles per hour and suddenly having an enormous pillow thrust in your face. A possibility that the National Highway and Transportation Safety Agency said had never occurred after millions of miles of testing. The auto industry would like nothing better than the Minnesota legislature punting this over to Congress, where they can tie it up hopelessly for the next two decades, which is how long it took the industry to agree to improved CAFE standards. Minnesota can't afford to wait for Congress. In 2007, the Minnesota legislature set a goal of reducing our global warming pollution 80% by 2050. The governor's climate change advisory group spent the next year developing the roadmap for meeting that goal. Nowhere in that report does it say that we should wait for Congress to adopt stricter emission standards. If we absolve the auto industry of its responsibility towards solving this problem, we have two choices. The first is to read through this list of recommendations and choose another sector of the economy to pick up the slack. The second is to tell Minnesotans that we will fall short of the goal that we set just 2 years ago. Even though cars with these standards won't be on the lot for four more years, we've heard from industry lobbyists that this bill will hurt their already ailing industry. While it would seem that a CEO should be a credible source for predicting the future of his or her company, that in the case of General Motors, the opposite is true. In 2006, while gas prices were rising and SUV sales were falling, General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner was predicting that the industry wouldn't see any permanent nosedive in their larger vehicle sales. By 2008, Wagoner admitted that $4 gas prices had forced a, quote, structural shift by American consumers away from large vehicles. His lack of foresight in 2006 is what makes him someone that Minnesotans can't trust to predict what's going to happen in 4 years. In fact, the current state of the auto industry should be proof enough that nobody is worse at predicting the future than the three gentlemen who flew to Washington, D.C. in their private jets to ask for a taxpayer bailout. Lobbyists for the auto manufacturers will also tell you that the protection of Minnesota's ethanol industry is a top priority for them. But in fact, the auto industry has historically been against Minnesota's effort to grow our ethanol market. An example? They have opposed their E20 mandate since Senator Dallas Sams first introduced the bill in 2005. Before a single drop of E20 had been produced and before a single test had been conducted, the industry declared E20 a failure and vowed to fight Minnesota's ethanol advocates in Washington, D.C. Bob Lutz said, "We absolutely guarantee the destruction of the engine and the fuel injection system if we go the E20 route." Representatives of the ethanol industry are quick to point out where California may have at one time fallen behind Minnesota in ethanol use. Yes, it's true that they had only three E85 pumps in 2007.
Mr. Chairman, I'm offended. The witness talked about Dallas Sam's E20 bill. That was actually the David's E20 bill.
Let the record stand that it was the David's.
I do stand corrected. The article referenced Senator Sam's. I stand corrected. Let's look at where things stand in California today. Last year, California invested $120 million in increasing ethanol availability throughout the state. In 2008, California joined with Minnesota in requiring all gasoline sold in the state to contain at least 10% ethanol, E10, which means that the market for ethanol in California is increasing by 800 millions of gallons of ethanol every year. This is more than Minnesota's total ethanol production. Perhaps even more compelling than a list of government initiatives is a look at what the private sector has done in response to California's new regulations. Things are booming so fast in California that Propel Fuels, one of the country's leading retailers of E85 and biodiesel, just moved its headquarters from Seattle to Sacramento. According to the company, California's greenhouse gas laws, alternative fuel programs, low-carbon fuel standard, and Governor Schwarzenegger's environmental and economic leadership were factors that led Propel to relocate. Propel's goal is to open hundreds of stations across the state within the next 5 years, creating thousands of jobs and raking in an estimated profit of over $200 million. Further, Propel predicts that by using California-grown fuels instead of importing foreign oil, it will generate $400 million in economic activity annually. 800 million gallons of ethanol, companies relocating to take advantage of a newly created market. It would be a shame for Minnesota to lose out on this type of economic growth. By contrast, the Star Tribune reported just last August that E85 availability appears to have stalled in Minnesota. Despite setting a goal of 1,800 stations by 2010, Minnesota hasn't made any progress beyond our 360 stations. The auto dealers will tell you that this bill limits their ability to trade cars with dealerships in other states, but let's dig a little deeper before accepting this at face value.
Folks, I'm very sorry. This is not about your testimony. We have to make this announcement again. The feedback and the buzzing that you're hearing on our audio system is because of people using laptops, cell phones, texting in the room. It's not just people right around the media table. It really extends to the entire room. So I would just really request very respectfully that anyone who's doing that, please refrain, and you can certainly go outside if you need to, but it does interfere with our system, and it's distracting and kind of messes up our official record of the hearing. So I'm sorry to have to interrupt you with that announcement, Ms. Schultz, but you can proceed and wrap up soon.
Okay. As we know, technology already exists to produce vehicles that don't emit as much global warming pollution. So what they're saying is that despite having 4 years of lead time, auto manufacturers won't be able to develop a business plan for ensuring that their products can be sold in neighboring states. 4 years seems like an awfully long time to develop a business plan. Minnesotans are getting sick of seeing Detroit post record losses each quarter. We're getting sick of hearing about plant closings and worker layoffs in our own backyard and across the country. These things aren't happening because environmental regulations are forcing Detroit to make cleaner, more fuel-efficient cars. If the auto industry is planning on doing something else besides build cars and develop plans to sell those cars, we have a right to know what they plan on doing instead. In a few minutes, seven people are going to come down here and tell you to oppose this bill. They're going to try to convince you that this change is something to be rejected. But the arguments of our opponents fly in the face of American ingenuity. We can't choose to delay action on the climate crisis simply because manufacturers are choosing to rely on expensive lobbyists instead of putting the best and brightest engineers to work developing new technology or employing the hardest working and most dedicated workforce in the world to keep America a global leader in manufacturing. We can't let residents of 14 other states drive more fuel-efficient cars than us simply because the auto dealers have chosen to spend their money on negative campaign literature instead of hiring Minnesota's most creative marketing firms to entice Iowans and Wisconsinites to come here and buy better cars than they will find in their own states. And we can't let other states pass Minnesota by in job creation and economic growth simply because the ethanol industry is choosing to focus on the past perceived shortcomings of California instead of looking forward and recognizing a new market with unlimited potential. I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership because Minnesotans need you to set a higher bar for our state than the one set by our opponents. If we wait for our opponents to define the right time for change, that day will never come. 81% of Minnesotans agree that the time for change is now.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. Are there questions of the witness?
Mr. Chair, I just would like to correct one impression maybe that was left. The ethanol industry is not speaking with one voice on this issue. There are agriculture groups that are neutral. There's a division within the ethanol community. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Probably about 3 or 4 to 5 minutes ago in your testimony, you talked about the changes in 2005 and about no studies on the E20. Could you go back to that part of your testimony and reread that statement?
The E20 mandate?
Yeah, you talked about, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, you talked about the E20 and the no studies being done or something and prior to the change in 2005.
So what I said was that the auto industry opposed the E20 mandate since Representative Greg Davids first introduced the bill in 2005. Before a single drop of E20 had been produced and before a single test had been conducted, the auto industry had already said that E20 would not work.
And Madam Mr. Chair,
Representative Holbert.
These wars have been going on for a really long time, and I'm not an ethanol supporter, never have been, but I know prior to 2005 there were tons of studies. The university, I got files and piles of stuff of how it works. So I think that the testing on the alternative fuels has been going on for a really long time, and so I just am not sure that I agree with the testimony, given the amount of studies. We had people up here from the university in Mankato that have been running cars with these alternative fuels and testing them. So I'm not understanding what your point was, but there was a lot of studying going on about it.
The point was, I think, that the auto industry opposed 20 from the word go. And whether lots of tests had been done or no tests had been done, in 2005 they were working pretty hard to defeat E20. They said it would void the warranty, it would destroy the engine, and these cars wouldn't operate.
Additional questions of Ms. Schultz? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Fortman, are there some additional orders?
Mr. Chair, we had a Reverend Mark Peters from the Evangelical Lutheran Church Association. He represents 1,200 Lutheran congregations in Minnesota, but he had an obligation with his child this evening, and I felt that members had enough information on the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hartman,
then David.
Is the Lutheran Church weighing in on this issue?
Representative David, this part of the Lutheran Church, I don't know about the whole Lutheran Church, I'm Catholic, so I don't know how many divisions and branches they have, but I know that a gentleman representing 1,200 congregations was here to speak to the bill, and that it is a part of their tenets of belief that safeguarding the Lord's creation is a part of their responsibility as Christians. That's my understanding of it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm one of God's great creations, and I feel more safe in an E85 Suburban than a Prius.
Representative Davis, you'll be glad to know that E85 Suburbans are approved under the new standards.
I'll call in Representative Turtle in a minute, but if Reverend Peters or anyone else who may have been inconvenienced by our change of time wishes to submit written testimony to appear on the record of this hearing, they certainly are encouraged to and are welcome to. So, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe if I told the people this afternoon I was a Norwegian Lutheran, they would have understood better. But come on, Norwegian Lutheran. Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Representative Portman. I was just wondering if you could tell us if there's any reason why we can't wait to find out what the Obama administration is going to do to enforce new requirements in the auto industry. I think the Obama administration has said that they're suggested that they're very serious about emissions, and wondering if you had any indication of what they might be doing and what the rush is now.
Representative Erdahl. Mr. Chair, the reason I think that we should act now is we were elected to lead, not follow, and that nationally when Al Gore was the Vice President of the United States and had just published a book on global warming, we saw zero action for 8 years. Washington, D.C. is a very difficult place to get things done, and the Minnesota State Capitol, I believe, is much more efficient. In addition, states have always been laboratories for national standards. And so by pushing forward at the state level, for example, the renewable energy standards, Congress was all tied up in knots about that, and they couldn't move forward on it. We've already done it. We're already moving forward on that. So there's no reason for us to wait for somebody else to pick up the burden of leadership.
Hey, any other additional questions of the author or of Ms. Schultz? Yes, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't sure if we were testimony both sides and then the author would come back, or do you want us to do questions with the author now, or which?
Well, if you've got questions of...
You're beat, your rules.
Well, if you've got questions of the author that, you know, are brief and not technical or would require a lot of explanation, you can ask those now. I would like to get to the opponent's testimony quickly, but...
You know what, we'll wait for Ms. Sherman, because they're probably not brief, so yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, I would like to hear from those who are opposed to this bill. And we had roughly about 20 to 25 minutes of testimony in favor. So I'm not going to be terribly rigid about this, but if people could, you know, keep within those guidelines, because I understand that I'm sure Representative Zellers is not the only one that wants to make a point following the testimony. So if you could keep within those guidelines, that's great. And I think, according to my list, I don't know if Eric Hyland or Laura Dooley are still here. I know we had a couple people that have to leave, which I, again, apologize for. But it looks like they're here.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask for a roll call on the final vote.
Okay. We will have a roll call on the final vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Eric Hyland, and I'm with the law firm of Meserly & Kramer. And this evening, I'm representing the Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers, and we're passing out our handout as we speak. The Alliance is a trade association of 10 car and light truck manufacturers, including BMW, Chrysler, Ford, General Motors, Mazda, Mercedes-Benz, Mitsubishi Motors, Porsche, Toyota, and Volkswagen. With me today is Ms. Laura Dooley from the Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers. But before I turn it over to Ms. Dooley, I'd like to make it clear to the committee that recent federal action, and no doubt future federal action, and the recent federal action that I would point out to the committee that the Alliance in fact supported, mean that there will be marginal environmental benefits. And in exchange for these marginal environmental benefits, consumer choice will be reduced. You will create powerful disincentives for the use of flex-fuel vehicles over the 85. Surrender the state's air quality standards to a board of 11 appointed persons in Sacramento, California, who have no obligation to pass policies that are best for Minnesota and Minnesota consumers. And before I turn it over to Ms. Dooley, I want to assure the committee that she arrived this morning on a regularly scheduled commercial domestic flight and not on a private jet crash. So with that, I'll turn it over to Laura.
Welcome to Minnesota, and welcome to the committee, Ms. Dooley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, my name is Laura, and I'm here today on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. I'm going to try to be very brief and squeeze in a lot of information, so if I speak too fast, just tell me to slow down. Obviously, we're here today to oppose the implementation of House File 690, which will implement the California Low Emission Vehicle Standards in the state of Minnesota. CALEV is the acronym that we use for this program. As we begin a discussion of the technical and policy implications associated with this program, I just wanted to give you a quick background of what we're actually talking about. The program comes in three components. The first component is called the Low Emission Vehicle Program. It regulates smog and ozone-forming emissions out of the tailpipe of the car, like volatile organic compounds, carbon monoxide, and other ozone-forming emissions. The second component is called the Zero Emission Vehicle Mandate, or the ZEV mandate. It's a battery-powered and hydrogen fuel cell mandate that's also intended to reduce smog and ozone coming from the tailpipe of the car. This one component of the CALEV regulation is scheduled to cost $1 billion annually only in the state of California for the six largest auto manufacturers. These two components provide absolutely no measurable environmental benefits above and beyond the existing federal program with which Minnesota already follows. In one of the charts we handed out, there's a little bit of a graph that shows the benefit of the California program versus the current federal program, and then compares it to a baseline of what was the reality in the 80s. The two programs overlap in this bottom line, and as you'll see, there's really no measurable benefit that you can point to. But it's really the third component that brings us here today. It's what most people associate with CALEV, and these are the greenhouse gas standards or the fuel economy standards under the California program. Just to be clear, current law does not allow that this component of CALEV, the fuel economy component, to be implemented in California or any other state at this time, and I'll get into the reasons why shortly. But more importantly, the auto industry shares the goals of this legislation. We disagree on the methods of achieving them. This isn't about mistakes of the past. It's not about Lee Iacocca. It's not about airbags. It's about how we can move forward together today to meet these goals. We agree that the best approach is a national program, a strong national program that's going to address climate change and not the California standards, which we strongly believe will result in product restrictions, eliminate incentives for E85 vehicles, relinquish Minnesota's authority to California, and establish a patchwork of constantly changing regulations that Minnesota's going to have to keep up with. It's because of this commitment that the Alliance supported the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. And I just want to be very clear. This is law. Congress adopted this law in December of 2007. Congress has already mandated that we improve the fuel economy of our fleet by upwards of 40%, and that's going to result in a reduction of at least 30% in carbon dioxide emissions. It's not something that we can stop as an industry at the federal level. It's done. It's part of law, and we were there to support it. In April of 2008, NHTSA, which is the regulatory agency, responded to that energy bill and released its proposal for what these fuel economy standards are going to look like for the beginning half of the program, from 2011 to 2015. They called for an annual 4.5% increase in fuel economy, which is already beyond the 3.3% increase that Congress called for in this energy bill of 2007. I want to point out that the proposed federal standards are higher for the combined car and light truck fleet than the California standards in model years 2011, 2013, 2014, and 2015. And that is included for you in this chart right here. This single national standard is obviously shaping up to be right on par with what California has already done. And we went ahead and did a little analysis using California's own numbers to talk about what the actual benefit might be. Now, I want to preface this by saying that we do not agree with most, if any, of the assumptions that California made within the standards. For various reasons, we think their numbers are inflated, but we'll give it to them anyway because they're in control of the program. So when we run the math, we find that the cumulative benefit between 2009 and 2016 for the California standards over what Congress just passed is 0.15%. That's what we're talking about, 0.15%. And again, we think that's inflated, so it's going to come down to zero very quickly.
The question I would pose to you is, why would you implement a public policy with such significant ramifications when you're talking about a 0.15% benefit at best? Just to kind of follow up quickly with what's going on at the federal level, I'm sure you've heard President Obama took a lot of action on this issue recently. He directed the Department of Transportation to quickly finalize these proposed CAFE standards. Again, they have to finalize something by March 31st. We encourage President Obama's urgency in finalizing these standards and suggest that they go ahead and do it all until 2015 so that we know what we're dealing with as an industry and we have certainty in that. Now, with the adoption of the Energy Bill in 2007, U.S. EPA denied California the necessary waiver to actually implement these fuel economy standards. That's also been subject to a lot of discussion lately. President Obama did direct EPA to revisit that decision. He did not tell them how to act at the end. And we think that his assurance that he's seeking a quote-unquote comprehensive approach that makes our economy stronger and our nation more secure positively reflects our position that a single national standard is really the way to go. Quickly to summarize, or I should say, until Minnesota, or California for that matter, is able to even implement these fuel economy standards, all you're adopting is a smog and ozone-forming emissions program, which I think we've already shown provides no benefit above and beyond what you're already living under. To quickly point out the probably three basic points, and I'll let others get into detail, we don't believe that the adoption of CalEV will support your state's commitment to 85 technology and infrastructure. Secondly, this California program will result in product restrictions. The stringency and the rigidity of the structure of the California program mean the only way that we can comply as auto manufacturers is to restrict products, and we're talking about larger passenger cars, SUVs, and light trucks. This will disproportionately impact Minnesota because you as a state favor light trucks and SUVs. It also will disproportionately impact industries that rely on these trucks for their livelihoods, like the construction trades or the agricultural trades, as well as larger families that rely on them for transportation. And finally, we don't feel that Minnesota should cede its authority to the state of California. The states are so vastly different, you don't want to tie your regulatory authority to a state that is not ours. We just ask that you allow the auto industry to meet the very challenging standards that have already been set at the federal level instead of asking us to comply with individual state-specific programs. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you very much, Ms. Julian. Again, I really do appreciate your traveling here and your flexibility in staying for the later hearing. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I didn't get your name to the lady that flew in on a 747. What was your name again?
Laura Dooley, D-O-O-L-E-Y.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Dooley, are you saying that in Minnesota, if this was adopted, there would be less selection and possibly job loss in Minnesota if this bill is passed?
I'll stick with the less selection part, and I'll let the dealers talk about job loss. But, Mr. Chairman, yes, we do believe that this program will result in product restrictions. We've already seen product restrictions in other states in the realm of flex fuel vehicles. In model year 2008, 30 models of flex fuel vehicles were available across the country. Only 19 of those models were available in California and other California states.
So, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dooley, we have big government telling us what cars we can and can't drive, in effect, here.
Sure.
Okay. I think the answer was yes.
Yes.
Yes, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm following up, I think, on a question that Representative Erdahl asked earlier about should we not wait until the EPA acts. I'd be interested to know, because it would help me understand the bill and the situation a little more, what specific provisions does the Alliance encourage the EPA to adopt? Could you feel specific about what you're urging the EPA to do?
Representative Morrow, Mr. Chairman, the EPA, I should correct the statement right now. This federal government is working on two tracks to discuss greenhouse gases. The track that we should be more specific about is what's going on with the U.S. Department of Transportation and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. They are currently promulgating rules to increase the corporate average fuel economy standards across the nation in conjunction with what was regulated, or mandated, I should say, in the Energy Bill from 2007. A proposed standard was issued in April of 2008, and that's what is shown on this document right here under the federal regulations. This proposal is basically what we have to go by right now. Our industry has commented on the proposal. We're supportive of it. We find it to be challenging in some aspects. It's certainly not an easy standard, but we're comfortable with it. The question is, what's the timeline and what will happen? Under the energy bill, U.S. DOT is required to at least finalize model year 2011 standards by April 1st of 2009. The reason that they have to hit that model year 2011 is to allow enough lead time for the industry. We are further encouraging DOT to issue the entire 2011 to 2015 block at once, so we have more consistency and can plan our product ahead in advance. To follow up and confuse us even more, the second series of regulations for 2015 to 2020 will be promulgated at a later time, and we can't put a date on that right now.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I have to follow up then. What I'm hearing is agreement on the CAFE standard increase that was discussed April 2008. And that's the one item to which the Alliance is prepared to agree or support or what have you. I'm not hearing there are others that maybe other groups or other advocates are calling for. This is the one thing. If I could then follow up to make sure I understand, does the California bill that we're talking about regulate the same precise issues and concerns as CAFE standards? For example, I think Minnesota State University of Mankato was referenced earlier. And while I think they do wonderful work, I think they need more money to do even better work on biofuels and emissions. But my understanding is that CAFE standards don't necessarily completely overlap with some of the other emissions questions or concerns. Could you touch on the interplay between CAFE and clean cars when it comes to emissions?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow, when we go back to looking at the California program in the three parts, I think we can divide it into two sections. Completely. The one being smog and ozone-forming emissions that are coming out of the tailpipes. Those are the pollutants in the air, the things that create smog. The California standard, two aspects, is directly comparable to the federal Tier 2 program. These are programs that were finalized, under the Clinton administration. That leads us to this graph where we show that the two programs are virtually the same, no difference. The second component, and it's what largely we've been talking about, is the regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. At the federal level, the greenhouse gas emissions program is the corporate average fuel economy standards, or the CAFE standards. Those are directly comparable to the fuel economy or greenhouse gas standards that are promulgated under the California program. They're commonly referred to as Table 1493 or the PAVLI standards. California always calls them greenhouse gas standards. To kind of anticipate the next question, why are they called greenhouse gas standards? California will insist that they're not fuel economy standards. They are greenhouse gas standards. 97% of the greenhouse gas emissions they're regulating are carbon, and that's what's regulated under the federal corporate average fuel economy standards, the CAFE standards. There's another 2 or 3% of greenhouse gas that they're being regulated. They come from the air conditioning system of a car, and that's what they're claiming makes it not a quote-unquote fuel economy standard. However, even California lists their rule as a miles per gallon target.
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, just in response to Representative Morrow's question, every federal court that's looked at this issue has determined that there is a difference between CAFE, which regulates fuel economy, and the Clean Car Standard, which regulates air pollution, which is our object. And Ms. Dooley did a very good job of articulating the position brought forward by the Alliance in the litigation, but every federal court that's ruled on this issue has ruled against that interpretation of the whether there's a conflict between the two federal laws.
Mr. Chairman, I would just follow up and say that that issue is being investigated in four different courts and one is yet to rule.
Yep, Mr. Chairman and Representative Morrow, maybe just to reiterate, and I think this is an important point. 98% of greenhouse gases from the operation of a motor vehicle comes directly from the burning of the fuel.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any additional questions of either Ms. Dooley or Mr. Hyland? Thank you very much for your testimony. The next testifier is Gary Hurwick from the Corn Growers. Is Mr. Hurwick still here? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hurwick. Thank you again for your patience and flexibility.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you and the committee today. Good evening, Mr. Chairman and the members of the committee. My name is Gary Hurwick. I'm a technical consultant for the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, and I'm a co-author of the January 2009 report that I believe all the members have already received, called a technical evaluation of California emission standards in Minnesota. That's this blue cover report. My experience includes over 30 years in vehicle emissions development and regulations, and in transportation fuel quality and alternative fuels. I spent the better part of my 35-year career working on California regulations and federal emission regulations as well. I was co-chair of the Emissions Committee at the Coordinating Research Council, the organization that conducted auto oil emissions research that formed the basis for many of our U.S. emissions rules and regulations. While at General Motors, I also helped guide the well-to-wheels research project in cooperation with Argonne National Laboratory that was first published in 2001. This was a definitive study of a life cycle energy use in greenhouse gas emissions of a full range of vehicle propulsion systems and transportation fuels. My testimony today will consist of brief comments on five aspects of the report of the having to do with the California vehicle emission standards that I think are pertinent to your considerations today. My testimony is based on our technical analysis conducted by an independent research team, including myself, on the actual benefits of the California program compared to the national program that is currently in place. First, since the Federal Environmental Protection Agency has taken the necessary steps to ensure that its program is as clean as possible, the programs produce virtually identical air pollution emission benefits. Our emissions inventory analysis of light-duty cars and trucks was done by a nationally recognized expert in the field, and our analysis compares emissions through the year 2020. Perhaps an unintended consequence of adopting the California program in Minnesota is that sales of popular models of cars and trucks would have to be restricted, and that would include flexible fuel vehicles that burn E85 ethanol. On a proportional basis, California currently has only 25% of the flexible fuel vehicles that the state of Minnesota has because manufacturers are not making them to California standards. That would mean far fewer FFEs in Minnesota that would be able to burn the E85 fuel. That would be unfortunate for Minnesota, since your state is the envy of all other states with your 360 plus E85 retail stations compared to California's current 20. That has been a point of contention with some of the proponents of the bill, and I can explain the reasons for this in detail if you wish. Our report also contains a detailed explanation of vehicle restrictions. The California program offers little greenhouse gas emissions benefit as well compared to the federal CAFE fuel economy standard, and in fact it actually might increase the greenhouse gas emissions by the Minnesota fleet. This is true even with the California vehicle CO2 standards that the Obama administration has indicated that they may approve for other states. There would be additional costs to the state to administer the California program instead of just allowing the federal government to do its job. That would include tracking compliance and monitoring the vehicle registration. As an example, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Quality issued a 50-page document that described how the new procedures would involve state personnel working with compliance and enforcement activity of the California vehicle standards. State taxpayers would be paying more for the additional work needed to manage the program. Finally, there is considerable uncertainty with regard to several relevant issues that the Obama administration is likely to take up soon. I've already mentioned the potential for EPA to grant a waiver to the state of California for its vehicle CO2 standards. That would mean that these standards would come along with the California air pollutant standards. In addition, new CAFE standards have not yet been issued, and it's possible that EPA will also regulate vehicle CO2 emissions as well. It seems to be premature to make a decision on adopting the California program before the federal program is settled at this point in time. A careful technical analysis of this complex issue shows that the California program offers no additional benefits compared to the current federal program, and would actually create several disadvantages that would include fewer E85 flexible fuel vehicles, potentially higher greenhouse gas emissions, and higher costs for the state. That's prior to several key changes contemplated by the new administration that are likely to make the federal program even more stringent for air pollution emissions, greenhouse gases, and also fuel economy. I thank you for your time.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to preface my comments by stating that when I was young, my dad asked me to join him at the Olmsted County Fair to volunteer in the corn growers booth. And I enjoyed the first time I went, and I went back for at least two or three other summers to volunteer in the corn growers booth at the Olmsted County Fair. In the district I represent, there are a number of people who definitely support flex fuel vehicles. We have more E85 stations going in southeastern Minnesota, and I'm definitely a supporter of E85 and flex fuel vehicles. I actually co-authored Representative David's bill and have been a supporter of ethanol in the state. I took the liberty to read your report, and I went through some of it. I won't say I went through all of it because it's very technical and I didn't have the time. This bill has been before the legislature for a couple of years, and we knew it was going to come to agriculture, so I had plenty of time to read over Representative Hortman's bill last year. And then this year, coming to transportation first, I wanted to get ready for the bill. And I can tell you I've read through a lot of information put out by both sides on this issue. I want to refer members to this that was put out by the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. If you all open up to page 4.5, it says, vehicles not available in California. A big issue has been raised about flex fuel vehicles not being available for sale in states that are going to be implementing the California standards. And so last night, after reading through all of these reports and having really thought about this, I really couldn't come to a conclusion on which way I was going to vote on this bill today. Because I have a lot of people who favor implementing the California standards, and I have a lot of people who favor E85 vehicles. So I asked staff this morning to call a couple states, and they called New York, and they also called Pennsylvania, two states that have implemented the California standard.
Mm-hmm.
I did not initially call anyone on this or call any dealerships about the cars on this list because I assumed that they wouldn't be available. So members, I just want you to look at this list, and I'll just let you know that my staff called Albany, New York, and asked, could they get the Dodge Dakota truck, flex fuel vehicle, as specified on this list? They were told yes. They called Reading, Pennsylvania. Could they get the Dodge Durango truck, flex fuel vehicle, specified here? They were told yes. They called Schenectady, New York.
Schenectady.
Thank you.
You're Albany and Troy.
As you can tell, I'm not a New Yorker. So they called New York, asked, can they get the Chrysler Town & Country minivan, flex fuel vehicle? They were told yes. Can they get, they called Hamburg, Pennsylvania. Can they get the Chrysler Town & Country minivan and flex fuel vehicle? They were told yes. Then they called Hanover, Pennsylvania and Albany, New York and asked about the Nissan truck, the Nissan Titan. Could they get that flex fuel vehicle? They were told yes. So I got that report at 12. So then I said, I want you to pick a couple California stations and ask the same thing. And I was only able to get a hold of one before committee. We called up the Santa Rosa Chrysler Jeep dealership, Santa Rosa, California, and asked, can we get the Chrysler Town & Country minivan flex fuel? They were told yes.
Okay, Mayor.
So, you know, I'm wondering, I'm not going to continue to go through this list, but this is information being put out, and people are saying, well, it's not available in California, it's probably not going to be available in the other states, and come to find out it is available in California and it is available in other states. I'm starting to question a lot of the information now that's been put out, and so I'm just wondering if you could respond to that.
Well, sure, I'd be happy to. This is a moving situation, and it's kind of a complex issue. So I guess that isn't an adequate answer, but let me address it specifically if I can, or as specifically as I can. I'll go back and reinvestigate the issue with these specific vehicles, and follow up on this in Pennsylvania and New York, and in the state of California as well. What I can tell you currently is the factual information is that as far as vehicle registration, that 10 out of 1,000 vehicles in California are flexible fuel currently, and 42 out of 1,000 vehicles in Minnesota are flexible fuel vehicles. So that's the basis for my statement and my testimony that on a proportional basis, only 25% of the flexible fuel vehicles are available in California as are currently available in Minnesota. The issue from a technical perspective is certification of flexible fuel vehicles to specifically the California PZEV and SULEV standards, which I believe you have a description of in your packet somewhere. Those two standards have evaporative emissions and tailpipe emissions problems that manufacturers are not able to certify flexible fuel vehicles to those two California standards. Today, that does not mean a huge portion of the vehicles. By 2012, I believe those two standards, the SULEV and PZEV standards, will be approximately 30% of the manufacturer's production for the state of California and for California adopting states. By the time we get to 2015, it is California's projection that 70% of the vehicles that a manufacturer produces will have to meet the SULEV and PZEV standards. That's because of the declining NMOG curve in the California standards. And what that means in our report and the analysis that we provided in the report is that there will be fewer and fewer flexible fuel vehicles available in California and in the California adopting states for that reason. Because, as I said in my testimony, the manufacturers are not producing flexible fuel vehicles to meet those standards, and they have no incentive to do so. As far as the vehicles that you point out, I can't specifically address that now, but I will do that.
Thank you. Are there additional questions? Yes. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Herwig, could you talk a little more about the cost of compliance that might fall on Minnesota if these standards are adopted?
Currently, the federal government tracks the compliance of the vehicle manufacturers to the given standards. Thank you for your question, by the way. I can't see your name. I'm sorry, I can't respond. Thank you, Representative Torkelson and Mr. Chairman. So that responsibility would fall on the individual state. In my testimony, I pointed out that the state of Pennsylvania issued a pretty large document, 50-page document, as I recall, on the procedures for tracking the vehicle registrations and also compliance to the, you know, to the declining NMOG standard. Manufacturers are required to produce vehicles which, if the state of Minnesota adopts the standard, you know, California standards, they would have to, they are required to comply with the declining NMOG average. It is up to the manufacturers to decide which standards they would select to certify all of their vehicle population to. They still have to meet the average, the NMOG average, as the thing declines year by year. But it would be up to the state to track that compliance to ensure that all the manufacturers met that. It would also be up to the state to make sure that all vehicles were certified to California standards that operate in the state. So there would be additional cost to that. What that cost is, I don't have a figure, but that's the...
Thank you. Are there additional questions? Well, thank you very much. Oh, yes. We have one more from...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chairman.
There was one more.
I wasn't sure whether to raise it now or raise it later. I don't know who else is on the list. I know the time is fleeting. Maybe, I don't know, I won't speak for Representative Davis. I drive an E85 vehicle. I'm part of that group, and I've got an ethanol plant in my district, and I've got one of the best corn-growing sections of the state. I don't want a bill that does something that kills E85 or ethanol. I'm very concerned about that.
Right.
At the same time, and I won't profess to have your knowledge of this, as I read through the same set of documents, I thought, well, that's not exactly what happened in California. As I read through the reams of documents over the last year and a half, my understanding in part, and I was hoping you could clarify this for me, and also I'm going to ask you a question that I'd like an answer later, because it'll take too long to answer, and I don't want to take too much of the committee's time. California can set the standards of what the emissions can be, and what a fleet does, GM, Chrysler, what have you, to determine, well, if we sell this smorgasbord of vehicles, and we get credits, and this is what it costs us for this type of vehicle, this type of vehicle, this type of vehicle, we can meet the standards. Do I have that part generally correct?
Yes.
They don't. And so, therefore, manufacturers were getting credit, I think, for selling E85 vehicles in California, but there were no E85 pumps, so people weren't actually using E85 in their flex fuel vehicles. That was a concern that California had stated. Do I have that part correct in the history of the development of this?
Manufacturers were selling E85 flexible fuel vehicles in California. Yes, that's true. California has some 350,000 flexible fuel vehicles in the state, but they weren't using any E85 fuel because there wasn't any available. Yes, that's true.
And so California was, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if I make it clear, California was looking for a way to measure actual usage of E85 in these vehicles, and I think there was someone who was sitting literally in the seat you're in today a year ago, said, well, either we'll do surveys of E85 vehicle owners, ask you how many gallons you used, or we'll check the onboard computer during regular servicing. Maybe we'll use the OnStar computer system. Does that sound familiar to you? Are you familiar with the compliance measurement that California was discussing within the last year?
Yes, I am. I'm not sure how you'd actually implement that. I think that there are some major issues with actually doing that. I think, there are some privacy issues, at least, with the OnStar tracking.
Well, and Mr. Chair, and I will try to bring this to a close, but this is the bulk of my concern. At one level, sir, I see the concerns. I see the concerns of the corn growers, the ethanol producers. I also think there's opportunity here for ethanol. I think that there's an opportunity for ethanol to be the way to actually comply with these standards. I agree, as someone else who sat in that chair a year ago said, there's a great uncertainty here. I would like to, and I would invite whoever it is in this room who can provide the information, I would like to get a sense of legally, one way or another, can the state of Minnesota implement measurement compliance compliance. We could take the number of V85 gallons sold in the state divided by the number of vehicles. Could we determine measurement and have to stick to the California standards, or are we required to not only take the standard, the emission standard, but we also have to use the California measurement compliance protocol? I have never gotten a definitive or a close to definitive answer. And truly, members, I would like an answer to that question because it would help me on this bill. I would also like, you talked about the SULEV and the PLEV, and you've lost me at that point. I think it's, again, the hour's like, could you maybe in writing talk more about why you argue that would hurt ethanol sales in the future.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I'm getting close on time here, I guess you have to tell
me. Mr. Herwick, you can answer that one question, then we do have three more testifiers that we'd like to get to quickly.
Now, with respect to tracking amount of the 85 use, I'm not sure how that would be done, and I'm not sure that anybody has actually proposed something to that effect. Certainly, you can take the total amount of gallons and divide it by the number of vehicles, as you suggested. With respect to having to track compliance with the California standards, you would have to determine that you meet the declining NMOG average. That was my point in the response to the previous question. So that's a separate issue, I think. But with respect to ethanol use, certainly that's an important thing. The important thing from my perspective is to have enough flexible fuel vehicles available that can use the E85 in order to use as much ethanol as possible. And certainly both the renewable fuel standard, the federal standard, and also the California low carbon fuel standard and the vehicle CO2 requirements are going to get far beyond the 10% ethanol blend that we're using throughout the state of Minnesota and also in California in another year. So we would hope that there would be lots of E85 used, and there is an opportunity to do so. The issue would be whether there are actually enough flexible fuel vehicles to use that quantity of ethanol.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Herwick.
Thank you.
Members, we have Stephen Ladley from the ethanol producers, Mr. Hausladen from the truckers, Ms. Schlandler from the auto dealers, and possibly someone from the Farm Bureau. I would say if the remaining testifiers could keep it to maybe 3 minutes each, and members, that excludes, of course, members' questions. And then we'll have some final Q&A with the author, and then we'll get to a vote. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Ladley.
Thank you, Chairman Hornstein, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. I am a farmer near Albert Lea, Minnesota, an investor in ethanol, and I'm on the board of directors of two ethanol production facilities in Minnesota, one at Lake Crystal and also Glenville, Minnesota. I am here today representing the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association. In the early 70s, I attended the University of Minnesota, and traveling up I-35 on Sunday evenings going back to school, I often came over to Burnsville Hill and witnessed the thick yellowish haze over the Minnesota River Valley. We seem to have forgotten those days. When Minnesota added 10% ethanol to the gasoline supply, it had a great part in making that haze go away, because ethanol creates a cleaner burning fuel that greatly reduces air emissions. Today we have many more vehicles than we did back then. But what about California at the same time? California at the same time chose a different road to travel. They chose to use the MTBE in their gas supply. The MTBE moved from the tailpipe into the municipal water supplies. It takes a very long time to break down and is proven to be a carcinogen. Thank goodness Minnesota chose ethanol and not MTBE like California did. Since then, MTBE, as many of you know, has been outlawed in all 50 states. Thousands of families across the state of Minnesota have invested in or are working in the ethanol industry. Even the state of Minnesota invested in this industry. As you know, we are a net exporter of this clean, green, renewable, environmentally safe fuel. Each one of us that either uses it or produces this clean alternative to oil appreciates any effort to further improve our environment, especially if we can lower emissions out of our tailpipes. A recent peer study out of the University of Nebraska, which I have available here, proves that corn-based ethanol emits an average of 51% less greenhouse gas than oil-based gasoline. Experts feel that number will improve even more in the foreseeable future. This proposed legislation would turn complete control of fuel standards over to an unelected board 2,000 miles away in California. In assessing greenhouse gas emissions, this same board has proposed assigning an indirect land use penalty on ethanol-blended fuels. Not on oils, not on schools, roads, houses, or anything else that uses land. They actually want to penalize me and other Minnesota corn growers for actions of loggers, ranchers, and other people that clear rainforests in South America. There is no scientific basis or scientific model for indirect land use, and it was not even conceived by a scientist, but by an attorney. In the last quarter of 2008, ExxonMobil made a staggering $14.8 billion, and others such as Shell has record profits. Recently, British Petroleum gave a $500 million grant to the University of California at Berkeley to study renewable forms of energy. Now, profit is not a bad thing. It is the goal we all strive for. But dollars can tend to persuade people's thoughts, especially when it's $500 million at a time. Now, does it make sense that oil was not included in this indirect land use scheme to limit renewable fuel expansion in the United States? I believe that this battle is often more about market share than it is what's best for our environment. Currently, we have a cleaner renewable fuel being mandated out of 90% of the market. We don't hear that it takes too much water to refine a gallon of gasoline, 41 gallons, only that it takes too much water to make a gallon of ethanol, 3 gallons. Minnesota, thanks to our legislatures, Department of Ag, and hometown investors, has always led the way in promoting and using renewable fuels. Even as a young industry, it generates $6 billion in economic activity and has helped to create 26,000 jobs all across our state. Are we putting our state ethanol industry at risk if we pass this bill? Why would we want to take this chance? This year, the nation is going to carry over 1.7 billion bushels of corn while using 3.3 to 3.5 billion bushels for ethanol. The two largest seed corn producing companies predict that an additional 5 billion bushels of corn due to greater yields through technology in the next 10 years. 5 billion bushels more corn on the same acres as that we use today. This increase, along with cellulose ethanol, gives us a way to help produce more fuels that we need. Today, if ethanol were a foreign oil producer, only Canada would supply the U.S. with more gasoline. We produce more ethanol today than we import from Saudi Arabia. We have started a clean, green, renewable, and environmentally friendly Minnesota tax-based industry, helping Minnesota build a stronger economy, roads, bridges, and schools together. I do not believe that we should have different standards than our neighboring states. That would make Minnesota a less attractive place in which to do business. People do not have to build businesses here, ship products here, and raise their families here. Everyone has a choice. It's our job to make Minnesota the best choice. Businesses and people are leaving California in droves because they cannot afford the cost of regulation. We in Minnesota do not have the problems that 37 million people and their millions of automobiles create. Minnesota is already ahead of California, and we at the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association strongly urge you to oppose this legislation. Thank you for this opportunity to share our views, and before I go, I want to ask you a personal favor. Each one of you should have received this green booklet in your packet. It's only 14 pages long, and it's got some real basic information on ethanol and maybe some things that might surprise you. Please take a couple minutes to review it. Any questions?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Ladley. Questions for the testifier? Thank you very much. We have Mr. Hausladen and Ms. Schlandler. We're already a bit over on the opponent's testimony, but I'm going to give you a little latitude here. But we do want to really, I would say, wrap up this section of our hearing by 7:30. All right. And I'm going to make that a pretty hard and fast time here. So, Mr. Hausladen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Hausladen, and I'm president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. We are here today to testify in opposition to House File 690, and I'll hopefully bring you a slightly different perspective because you've heard about manufacturers and the fuel, but I want to talk about being a user in this system in a world governed by CARB. The trucking industry is committed to preserving the environment and reducing carbon emissions, and frankly, we demonstrate that commitment every day, whether it's running new engines that eliminate or emit one-tenth of particulate matter that they did just a few years ago, by burning new ultra-low diesel fuel or biodiesel blends, by adding auxiliary power units to our trucks, or yes, even voluntarily reducing our driving speeds to 65 miles an hour. There's a handout being passed out that you can look at on your own. It shows what we have done in terms of the engines we use, the mandated reductions, and the dramatic efficiencies in terms of the pollutants that we put out. On the backside, you'll see what is actually being emitted, and it's a great story from our industry. And while we'd like to acknowledge the author's attempt to eliminate commercial vehicles, our reading of the bill would indicate that it actually does not do so. And that's what I'd like to go through here quickly tonight. By incorporating California Code of Regulations, Title 13, Sections 1900 through 2235, this bill actually does directly regulate heavy truck engines, big truck engines. And while many of the testifiers today can only speculate what life would be like under California developed regulations, we can tell you what it's like firsthand. Our trucks, many of them at least, go to California and deliver each and every day. And thus, they're subject to the regulations developed by the California Air Resources Board. And what I can tell you, and what my members tell me, is living under a world regulated by CARB is very challenging, and it's very costly. There are at least 10 major CARB regulations that directly impact trucking. And while these regulations may have merit, in California's unique geography, weather patterns, and density, they don't work well in Minnesota's very different environment. So three quick examples. First, under CARB, truck engines must automatically shut off after 5 minutes of running time. Now, if you're in sunny San Diego, that's not a problem. But if you're a truck driver in your bunk in the middle of a cold January night, when it's below zero and that truck shuts off, it's very hard to keep warm. Another example, under CARB, by January 1, 2010, all trucks older than model year 1994 will be banned from certain ports. Now, that might make sense for the crowded port of Long Beach, but not Port Bungie and Savage, where grain trucks are hauling every day in the fall. Third example, under CARB, any truck may be inspected for excessive smoke, immediately fined $300, and face an additional $500 if the repair is not made within 45 days. And again, I offer to you that might make sense in heavily congested Los Angeles, but not for an older model truck pulling a load of asphalt for a rural road project in Nicollet County. Now, the hard part to share about this is that those CARB regulations are so onerous that some of our members have actually decided to simply just not do business in California. It's just too hard. They just focus on other states. And our concern is that adopting California's vehicle emission standards will have similar negative impacts, not just for trucking, but for the entire economy of the state. And that chart that you looked at, the reductions are very impressive, but they've come at a cost, and that cost wasn't cheap. Just for comparison, in 2001, before the first series of the low-emitting engines were required, a typical truck engine cost $20,000. That's right, that's just the engine, not the whole vehicle. In 2010, when the next generation is fully implemented with all of its retrofittings and particulate filters, it's going to cost $35,000. We're going from $20,000 to $35,000 in 9 years' time just to meet the mandate. And frankly, our industry would like a little credit for the increased cost we have already borne to do our part to improve the environment. With more than 75% of the state's manufactured freight hauled by truck, and 68% of the communities served exclusively by truck, the cost of implementing CARB will impact every citizen. This bill also directly impacts an important sector of our industry through its regulation of medium-duty vehicles. Mr. Dave Cashman couldn't be here. He's from Speedy Delivery in St. Cloud. You have his testimony being passed out. I think just simply put, right now under the definition, Speedy Delivery, Minnesota-based company, lots of jobs, lots of trucks, they are going to be directly regulated by this, and they have lots of questions. They are struggling to survive in a challenging environment, and they don't know if they can use the trucks they have, if they can buy the new ones, will they fit their business model, will it cost more? A lot of questions. So in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, we do share the author's desire to preserve Minnesota's environment. We're doing it in a lot of ways already. However, from our practical experience, we just don't believe that putting our current and future regulations for vehicles in the hands of CARB is the best approach. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions quickly? Thank you. We have one last testifier, and that is Alyssa Schlander from the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. If you could maybe keep it to a couple minutes, that would
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I will do my best to be brief. A lot of what I was going to say has already been said tonight anyway. My name is Alyssa Shalander. I'm with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Members, I represent the auto dealers. We are not the manufacturers. We represent the Minnesota businesses who own the property, own the buildings, employ the employees that work in this state. And most importantly, we are in a franchised relationship with the automakers. And what that means is that we are required to buy supply from them according to what they tell us to buy. This particular regulation regulates what the auto, it all hinges on what the automakers deliver for sale into the state of Minnesota. And what that means for the dealers who buy the vehicles from the auto manufacturers is that we are going to be sort of put upon with with supply that really gets put on our lots regardless of demand. And so just keep that in mind as we're talking about what is really being regulated here. I know we're short on time, Mr. Chair, but the couple important things that we care about in this bill. With respect to the air pollution regulations of the California system, that's where we would be required to sell California-certified vehicles and nothing other than California-certified vehicles. That's a different type of vehicle than a vehicle that's certified to EPA standards. And what that means for us is that we'll limit our ability to do dealer trades with dealers in our surrounding area. If a customer comes into a showroom and says, I want a navy blue Chevy Impala with leather seats, and the dealer doesn't have a navy blue Chevy Impala with leather seats, he'll call somebody in Iowa who does have that vehicle, and they can trade inventory, and they'll get to, the dealer in Minnesota gets to keep the sale local and satisfy the customer's income. I'm trying to be brief, I'm sorry.
Give me a couple more minutes.
We would not be able to do that under this bill because our surrounding states would not be stocking California certified vehicles. Now, with respect to the flex fuel vehicles, that is another very important issue for Minnesota dealers. I mean, it might not be a big deal in the metro area or on Iron Range, but there are certainly very important areas of the state where customers demand to drive flex fuel vehicles for very important reasons. Now, Representative Welty, I know you brought up that you did some research by calling other dealers. That is not my report. The Corn Growers did that report, and I don't actually know where they got those numbers. But you might be interested to go to the U.S. Department of Energy. It's got a great website called fueleconomy.gov. You go on there, search for any kind of vehicle you want, and it's got a listing of all the alternative fuel vehicles, and they'll list where some flex fuel vehicles are not offered for sale. So it's not some fallacy that you can't get these flex fuel vehicles in certain geographic areas that are governed by CalWEP. U.S. Department of Energy, agrees that they're just not being offered in certain areas, and that's a fear for us. We've got a big market here in Minnesota, and if there are, more than half the models of flex fuel vehicles that we can't provide for our customers, that's lost sales. That's a big deal. Finally, I just want to talk briefly about the carbon emissions section of the bill.
Okay, maybe make this one point, and then we have a question from our Representative Davis, and we'll run.
Okay. The carbon emissions portion of the bill, as was stated earlier, is not about equipment on the vehicle. The only way we're going to reduce carbon emissions is to burn less fuel. There's nothing we can do to the car to make it to capture the carbon. We just have to burn less fuel. And these regulations work on a fleet-wide average. So as the fleet is delivered into the state of Minnesota, the manufacturers are going to have to figure out what is the right mix of vehicles that they're going to give to us, that they're going to make us buy, that will meet the fuel economy targets as a fleet. What I'm trying to say is, in order for manufacturers to meet the carbon emissions portion of the California regulations, they are going to require us to buy more, smaller, lighter vehicles, regardless of demand for them, and restrict our ability to provide our customers with bigger vehicles that get less fuel economy. There is no other way to meet these carbon emission standards under the California system other than for them to fix the fleet and to fix the mix of vehicles that they deliver into the state of Minnesota. That's going to leave us with vehicles we can't sell. And by the way, we buy these vehicles as soon as they get to our lot, and we finance them every single day until we can sell. I'll be back.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. And Representative Davis had a question, I believe, for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Shalander, would you say that, you know, if you're selling less vehicles and so forth, I know that the auto dealers are down, you're losing many, many dealerships. Do you believe that if we adopted this standard, there'd be jobs lost in the state?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, yes, absolutely. This is absolutely disrupting our ability to market and sell product in the way that meets consumer demand.
Well,
it's going to cost us more money. Costing businesses money absolutely costs jobs.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Shalander, you know, first of all, I don't understand for the life of me why we'd want to do anything the way California does. I just don't get it, or give any of our power to do anything to California. The author of the bill said this is the Clean Car Act. I believe it's the Job Loss Act of 2002, the Truck and SUV Minivan Rationing Act of 2009, and having to go into a smaller vehicle, I mean, kick the auto industry when they're down, Act of 2009, and to get to, you want to see me in a Prius? I mean, think about it. This act should be called the Unsafe at Any Speed Act of 2009. That we should vote this down.
Well, just for the record, it was an hour and 34 minutes before anyone referenced California comparisons to Minnesota. In that way. Did you want to respond in any way, Ms. Shalander?
I don't think there was a
question. Okay. members, are there, if there's no other questions for Ms. Shalander, thank you very much. And I did want to let people know that Kevin Tapp was unable to attend this evening, but we do have his testimony from the Farm Bureau Federation before you. So please reference that, and we really appreciate the Farm Bureau's participation in our hearing. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where does this bill go if it were to pass?
Well, it will go to Representative Eakin's Environment Policy and Oversight Committee, but before we take a vote, if I know that Representative Zellers, I know at least Representative Zellers, maybe others, had final questions of the author, and then we'll have the author very briefly summarize any other points, and then we're going to get to a vote. I understand also Representative Erdahl is on the list as well. So, Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the last time we heard this bill, I brought this up to Representative Hortman. I've got a very large auto auction in my district, right next to 169 and 694. At that time, when I asked, I said, how is this going to affect their ability to sell cars? They sell a boatload of cars. They've got a boatload of dealers that are in our shops, our restaurants, staying in our hotels on Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. And although I love our state greatly, there's not a lot to do on a cold January day and Wednesday, even in Maple Grove, make them a surprise. You know, the conversations I had after last year said that this would markedly not only influence, but deter their ability to sell these new cars, and wouldn't just be, because it's not just Minnesota dealers that are buying here. These are dealers from Fargo, Sioux Falls, Iowa, you name it. Has anything changed since then that would lessen the effect on those the auto auctions, and not just one in my backyard, but the several that are across the state of Minnesota?
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you may be also aware that I'm in the auto industry myself, and we sell for a number of used auto parts, and we're probably the largest customer at that auto auction in your district. And I'll tell you this year what I told you last year, which is that the standard applies to new motor vehicles with a model year 2013 and later, and it does not impact used autos in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then going forward, if, say, it's 2016, 2017, and some entrepreneur from Sioux Falls has another business that he wants to dump a bunch of a fleet of new cars into, could he come over, could he buy a South Dakota style car here in Minnesota if it's after the deadline then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sellers, what has happened in the states that have adopted the standard is that people in neighboring states do come to them to get cars that are less polluting. And so in the particular instance of the greenhouse gas emission standards, because they will make cars more efficient, I would imagine that if I were a fleet operator in South Dakota and I could get a more fuel-efficient fleet from an auto dealer in Minnesota, I would probably purchase that fleet in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one question about the chart, because I got this book when I took college staff, so it was a little red book, and I can't find it anymore, but it was about statistics, and it said, statistics lie, and liars use statistics. So you, Madam, I want to always make sure that we're specific on the numbers. So on the one chart that you had from climate change, number 26, I'm just curious as to the math that, how we got to the $20 savings, the net monthly savings. I guess was there a dollar amount for the car? Was there a dollar amount going forward per gallon? Because I see the 174 and the 5 gallon. I hope you're wrong about $5 a gallon gasoline, though. But I'm just curious about the math of how we get there, because I think that's, for a lot of people when they're looking to buy a new car, that's a big difference.
Representative Hortman. Representative Sellers, the presumption is that a new vehicle in 2016 would cost $1,026 more if it were a passenger car or light-duty truck. If it were an SUV, it would cost $1,047 more. And the presumption was made that the average person finances a vehicle because very few people can walk in and pay for the full cost of a new vehicle, since this only applies to new vehicles. So the typical person would pay a monthly car payment. And so then dividing the car payment over the life of the car and looking at the monthly car payment and comparing that to the monthly gas bill is where the numbers net out. And that math was initially done by the California Air Resources Board, but you may be aware that the governor appointed a stakeholder group to look at Minnesota's situation, and they did separate math for our state, coming up with very similar numbers.
Okay. That's never at all.
Yes, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we all want clean air in here. We always like to breathe clean. Even Representative Davids would want clean air. But it becomes, you know, in some ways this year a matter of timing as well. You know, Representative Hortman, I'm concerned about the impact on Minnesota jobs. I fear with the distress in the automobile industry and our local auto dealers in Minnesota that they, at this point, don't need anything more dumped on them that could potentially cost jobs and or shut them down. We have three auto dealerships in Litchfield, and one of them closed last week, and 18 jobs were lost. At this point, I question whether the benefits are worth the cost in Minnesota now, and I question also if Minnesota is an island in the middle of the continent, what impact lessening emissions in this state would have. So the question is, what do you think is the impact on jobs?
President Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, the Ford Ranger meets every version of the Ford Ranger that's produced meets the California standards, for one thing. So with regard to auto worker jobs in Minnesota, I am not concerned. And in fact, I do believe that what the auto industry needs and what their own papers they filed with Congress say that they need is to innovate and improve the product that they're selling, to actually make the product that consumers want to buy. And their plans that they've submitted to Congress say their path to viability is to make more fuel-efficient cars. So I don't see this as a burden. I see this as a lifeline in helping them to transition. With regard to jobs in Minnesota and dealerships closing down, you know, the auto manufacturers have put as a part of their restructuring plan that they're going to fire a bunch of UAW workers, they're going to reduce the benefits that they're paying, and they're going to close dealerships. Whether we pass this bill or not, GM, Ford, and Chrysler have a plan to dramatically reduce the number of car dealerships they have. I'm very sorry for the things that have happened in Minnesota in the last year to our automotive dealerships, but it has absolutely nothing to do with my legislation. The way to get auto dealers successful again is to have them sell cars that we can afford to buy and that we can afford to drive.
Thank you. Representative Moyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Corbin, I appreciate what I take to be your ongoing commitment to listening to the concerns and the information. I'm just looking at the Minnesota Farm Bureau letter, and Farm Bureau President Papp says that Minnesota Farm Bureau's concerns with this bill in its current form do not mean that farmers are against clean air, and I think he's absolutely right. And I think I have concerns, as you know, and as I've shared with you, but I do think this isn't the last stop for this bill. I look forward to hearing some of the information that I asked for from the Tessa Farm, from the corn growers, and as we can try to achieve some more certainty about this one way or the other. So I do hope and I do appreciate your commitment to continue to listen and that we can hear from all the groups here about some of the questions I think are still remaining. I think there is still some uncertainty.
Mr. Chair and Representative Morrow, and I really appreciate the dialogue that I've had with the Farm Bureau in particular. And we met more than 15 times with regard to this bill, and everything about the 2009 draft incorporates suggestions from the Farm Bureau, from the Farmers Union, and from the corn growers in 2008, concerns about state-specific data, state-specific compliance, making sure we're looking at what's happening in Minnesota and that we're adopting a standard that works for Minnesota, and that's incorporated really mostly on pages 5 and 6.
Hey, I do not see any additional members.
I'm sorry.
Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, this is an issue that hasn't really been addressed, and I'm curious about it. And it may be for a representative of the manufacturers, and maybe Representative Cortman knows, but it's regarding the language on page 6, lines 10 through 14, where it talks about a domestic supply report, where it tasks the manufacturers to annually report what percentage of fuel used in a motor vehicle delivered for sale in Minnesota was produced in the United States. And I don't know a lot about this, but I'm guessing that a manufacturer can have piles of steel and they buy from various suppliers depending on availability and price, and they all might get melted together and made into parts. And I'm wondering, is this even workable? How would you determine where the steel comes from and segment out Minnesota-bound cars versus other cars from various plants? And
Representative Fortman or a member of the public?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I know that's an intensive conversation that we'll be having in the Commerce Committee. It sounds very much like a Commerce Committee issue. But as operators of businesses, they have a great deal of information about the inputs and the costs in their products. And I am certain that they can provide this information to the state of Minnesota. As consumers in the state of Minnesota, concerned about jobs in this country and jobs in this state, I think we have a right to know how much U.S. steel is in the cars that are being sold here and the trucks and SUVs, and how many of these vehicles are made in the United States of America. For example, we're hearing that the Ford Motor Company has a plan to shut down the Ford Ranger plant. Well, they just opened one up in Mexico, and they have one in Thailand. I want to know when they ship vehicles to Minnesota where they're coming from.
And I think Ms. Dooley looks like she may want to weigh in on this issue.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Holbrook, in reviewing the language, you certainly discussed this provision, and I think it's important to point out, no, this is not an intuitive report. It's something that's going to be a challenge. If it's required, manufacturers are not in a position to not comply with the report. This, however, is an excellent example of how the CALA regulations are different in every single state. It allows for another report than manufacturers, and it's unclear whether or not it's just the large volume manufacturers, the intermediate volume manufacturers, the small volume manufacturers, who all meet different regulations under the California program, which ones of those have to comply. It is a serious concern of ours that it's included within the report, but again, if it does become law, it's something manufacturers will have to comply with. I don't know the obstacles to do that, but I've been told it's going to be a significant challenge.
And if I might, I know you want to wrap up here, but I just want to have one question here. At what point in the production of a car does the manufacturer know what state it's headed to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, I can't answer that question. I can certainly take it back to my manufacturers and get an answer for you for trying.
This seems to be very cumbersome, and I'm sure that if it makes it commerce, it'll be discussed there as well. So thank you.
Okay. And I believe Representative Davids had a question. or comment?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, with all these reports and everything, who's going to read it? Does anybody want to read it? Why are we having a report that nobody wants to read? Just a thought, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe a good novel or something.
Your books are better.
Okay. Are there any other questions or comments to the author from members of the committee? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Portman, could you talk a little bit about the Minnesota truckers' concerns?
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal, Mr. Chair, members. When the Minnesota Trucking Association first approached me and let me know that my bill inadvertently scooped into it this year, some of their members, I asked for the specific language we would need to take them out, because it is not our intention to regulate commercial vehicles. In fact, the low emission vehicle program in California is a passenger vehicle program, and so our reference to the low emission vehicle program by definition excludes any parts that would regulate big heavy trucks, and we have no intention of going there. But then I was approached last night at after the Transportation Finance Committee, and I was instructed by the Minnesota Trucking Association they weren't going to give me the language to take them out of the bill, because whether I took them out or not, they were still going to oppose the bill. So I still have the problem of coming up with a language to take them out, but I can assure you that we will be taking out commercial truckers in whichever way we have missed them in our current exemption for commercial trucks. We will be taking them out in the next committee.
Representative Oakleson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for missing the author's opening remarks this evening. I had another meeting, but what I'm concerned about is what might happen in the future coming out of California. How can we be certain that Minnesota's voice will be heard concerning any changes that might be made by either the California legislature or the CARB?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the way that we would get out is the same way we got in. The legislature would take action to revert to the federal standard. And when California develops a new stage of its program, it's gone from LEV 1 to LEV 2, and they're projecting in the future to go to LEV 3. It's about a seven-year process from conceptualization to approval by the EPA and implementation. So we would have a multi-year period as a legislature to decide we want to opt out. What the bill does is it requires the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency to provide notice to the chairs of the Commerce Committees, the Agriculture Committees, and the Environment Committees when California proposes any changes to the program. So the key legislators in leadership position would be getting notice. Also, the governor would be getting notice, and the commissioner of Agriculture. So, and lawmakers, I'm certain, will be keeping an eye on it so that if there are proposed changes, we have that entire lead-up time through development and prior to implementation to opt out and go with the federal standard.
Thank you.
Well, okay. And let's get to that point. If you wanted a deliberative process as far as adopting changes to the California standards, then why would you provide for an expedited rule process that would be on autopilot, excuse the pun, and that would move towards conforming with any changes rather than making it go the other way, and that there'd be an affirmative action by the legislature in order to conform?
Representative Horton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, that provision, what it does is it saves money in the rulemaking process, because under federal law, we're allowed to choose chocolate or vanilla. We can't make a Swiss cone. There's only two standards, right? So we're either under the EPA regulations or we're under the California regulations. Minnesota doesn't have to write new regulations, so we don't need a staffer at the PCA to try to replicate what exists in California code, because we're not allowed to do anything that's different. So the reason we have expedited rulemaking is because all the black and white text already exists that we'll be adopting as our rules. And the updates are to comply with minor changes over time, because, for example, you have a packet of some of the executive orders approving automobiles, like the H2 as a super ultra-low-emission vehicle when it's running on E85. Every time CARB approves more vehicles, we don't want the legislature to have to convene and vote on it, because that happens like every 2 weeks. So it just doesn't inject the legislature into the sort of minutia, but what it does is it reserves for the legislature plenty of notice to react when the standards are proposed to be changed.
Representative Hortman. Representative Holder.
And
Hortman.
We've
been called each other over the years.
And thank you, and I appreciate that. I'm very nervous. I think we, as a state, by rightly so, you can't have the twist cone, you can't pick and choose, but to adopt these standards, be subject to any changes that they make, to have those changes be enacted by expedited rulemaking. I mean, it just really seems like, you know, California is, we put them in the driver's seat, if you will, for our fuel emissions regulations, and I'm very uncomfortable with that.
Okay. Yes.
Just a follow-up remark. You know, if those minor changes come along and they affect the minorities, say farmers or just truckers, I can see where it might be difficult for us to get the effort through the legislature to get back on EPA standards and off of California. Just really a comment, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the commitment to ethanol and the concern about Minnesota's ethanol industry, I think, crosses all geographical segments. As a suburbanite, it's very important to me that Minnesota have a very strong, very viable ethanol industry. And so I hear what you're saying, though.
Representative Fortman, any last thoughts before we vote?
Mr. Chair, I think I just would want to note that I agree with almost everything that Mr. Ladwig said, but he was really speaking to the fuel standard issue, and the fuel standard is House File 86, and that's a different conversation for a different day. I would also just say, with regard to the issue of federal leadership, President Obama issued an executive order allowing the states to go ahead. He did not issue an executive order asking EPA to put into place carbon dioxide regulations for motor vehicles, and because we can reduce 13.1 million metric tons of pollution between now and 2025 if we take action, I would encourage members to vote yes.
Okay. Before we vote, members, I did want to, first of all, thank the committee for your patience today and for some really good questions throughout the day at both of our hearings. And I also especially want to thank the staff for their staying late and their flexibility. Really proud of this committee today and the work that we've done. So with that, and of course members of the public who also hung in there with us. With that, Representative Hortman renews her motion that House File 690 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Environmental Policy and Oversight. A roll call has been requested, and the clerk will take the roll on the bill.
Champion.
Aye.
Davis.
No.
Hausman.
Yes.
Holbert.
No.
Fortman.
Aye.
Leader.
Pass.
Mason.
Yes.
McFarland.
No.
Morrow.
Aye.
Rosenthal.
Aye.
Torkelson.
No.
Erdahl.
No.
Welty.
Yes.
Zeller.
No.
Okay. The chair votes aye. I have to think about it for a while.
The apprehension.
Okay. The vote is as follows: 8 ayes, 6 nays. We had 1 abstention and 1 absence. The Representative Leader, do you continue? Okay.
Vote aye.
Chair Leader votes aye. So the final vote is 9, 6, and 1 absence. The bill is passed on to the Environment Committee. We are adjourned. We'll be meeting next members, we do have one meeting of this committee prior to our regularly scheduled meeting, and that is the joint meeting with Transportation Finance on February 24th at 4:30. If you like clean cars, you're going to love land use.
Mr. Chair, members and pages, I will reuse the color papers, so please don't throw them in recycling. I will pick them up.
Our meeting's adjourned.